Secretary, please call the roll.
Good morning. Let the record reflect Commissioners Soboroff, Madison, Figueroa Villa, and Saltzman are present, and we have a quorum. Number one on the agenda, Commission comments.
Your happy holiday wishes, Commissioner?
So I've been on the commission, well, this is my second Christmas, probably a year and 4 months. And honestly, from the bottom of my heart, thank you to all of the officers, all of the civilian staff, for all you do. And please have a safe Christmas. You know, we wait for you to come home at night. So happy holidays.
Commissioner Saltzman?
Sure. I don't think I could say it any better than Commissioner Figueroa Villa, other than say I agree completely. And I thank everyone for their service. And be safe. Thank you.
Commissioner Madison.
What do I say but that I echo everyone else's comments, and I'm thrilled to see all of the festivities for the children and the toys and the shoes and trying to make sure that the least of us have more than what they usually have. So thank you to LAPD for making that happen for so many people here in Los Angeles. Thank you.
And again, I want to echo what everybody else said. And add one thing. You know, when we say happy holidays, everybody says, so where are you going? What are you doing? And what goes unnoticed is you guys are here all the time, 24/7, Christmas Day, New Year's Day, Christmas Eve. And I just want to make sure that you hear from us how much that is appreciated. And sometimes goes unnoticed in people's day-to-day lives, but being an officer is a difficult thing. Being a great officer is a more difficult thing, and we have a lot of great officers here, and we appreciate everything you do. And when I say happy holidays, I hope you do get some time to enjoy and be safe.
Thank you. Item number two on the agenda, the report of the Chief of Police, Chief Beck.
Morning, Chief.
Good morning, Commissioners, and thank you for your comments. You know, this is a great organization of which I am very, very proud. And this time of year is a particularly poignant time because it's a time where we reflect on all of the events of the past year, and there have been many. And I won't sugarcoat it. This has been a very difficult year for the Los Angeles Police Department. We have lost three officers in the line of duty and another 10 to illness or accident while off duty. And it's been a tough year. But I have been extremely proud of the organization during the recent protests and the way the organization responded and the humanity and the professionalism and the effectiveness that they showed, I think, are truly the hallmarks of what the LAPD is all about. We do the difficult things. Sometimes we make them look easier than we should, but I think that it goes well appreciated by people that view us and then view what other cities deal with and how they deal with it. On to my normal report on crime. We continue to have a reduction in Part 1 crime for the year, although it is small, 2.4%. I think that is more significant when you look at it in the world of crime. We'll have over 100,000 Part 1 crimes, or add 100,000 Part 1 crimes at the end of the year, and a 2.4% reduction is almost 2,400 less victims. And so it's an important stat. It's a 5.7% reduction compared to 2012, so the city continues on a steady crime decline. All categories of property crime, burglary, theft from vehicle, burglary, motor theft, personal theft, others, all those categories are down. We continue to struggle in comparison to last year with violent crime. We have had one more homicide at this time this year than we did this time last year. We're at 243 as of Sunday, and we were at 242 same time last year. Of significant note, we have not had a homicide in the city of Los Angeles since this past Thursday. Now, I would hope that trend continues, but we will see. Rapes are up in the city, 11.8% compared to last year, and just under 1% compared to 2012. Robberies are up less than 1% at 0.5% compared to last year, and are down 12% compared to 2012. Aggravated assaults continue to be the category we struggle with the most. Part of that is an effort to classify these things correctly as we translate them from California penal codes to the UCR codes. You'll hear more about that in your presentations to the commission today. But also a significant part of it is an increase in domestic violence across the city. And as we look to next year, that will be one of the department's initiatives. And the mayor and I will talk more about that in our crime stat press conference. I believe it's scheduled for January 8th. But domestic violence is a crime that cuts across all boundaries. It's also a crime that has a lingering effect on the people involved. The victimology for young people that are exposed to violence in their home continues throughout their life and affects how they perform as adults and whether or not they become violent themselves in later years. So this is an important thing and something that the city as a whole will have to address. That gives us a little over 11% increase in violent crime compared to last year and a 1% increase compared to 2012. Victims, number of victims shot are down 6% in the city compared to 2013 and down almost 21% compared to 2012. We have made tremendous progress in the most violent of violent crimes, and it is traditionally or has been over the past year the lower end of violent crime that we struggle with, and I think you'll hear more on that later. Our bureaus, the Central Bureau shows an increase in crime year to date. All the three other bureaus are down. Gang-related crime is down a little over 5% in the city compared to last year, 21% compared to 2012. A significant impact, particularly considering the events that are being discussed nationwide. Officer-involved shootings are down in the city of Los Angeles. We've had 29 year-to-date as compared to 43 last year at this time. The highest year in my tenure as chief of police was 2011, and we have had exactly half as many officer-involved shootings this year as we did in 2011. So that's significant progress in an area that I think is on the national front page. Traffic collisions are up 3.7% in the city. To give you an idea of the volume, that's 43,500 as compared to last year's 42,000. Significant traffic accidents, those that involve injury or death, are down 2.6%. So even though we have a slight increase in total accidents, the significant accidents, the ones that cause death or significant injury, are actually down in the city. Driving under the influence involved traffic accidents are down about 1% in the city. Hit and runs are about even. We've had approximately 60 more hit and runs overall this year compared to last. But just as it is with traditional traffic collisions, serious injury and death involved hit and runs are down significantly, about 16%. Motor vehicle versus pedestrians are up slightly, but significant motor vehicle versus pedestrian accidents, those that cause injury or death, are down slightly. Bicycle-involved traffic accidents are down significantly since last year, overall 9.4%, and more serious categories are down almost 24%. Total personnel on payroll, we have 9,930 police officers, 2,732 civilian personnel, We have just under 500 reserve police officers, 372 specialists, 63 chaplain volunteers, and 5,445 cadets in the program. And you'll hear from some of them today. And that concludes my report.
Chief, one question. Last year was the year of traffic. I want to let you know that my family took it seriously. We had only two accidents last year versus four the year before, so we were down 50%.
Well, you know, we've had 43,000 accidents in the city of Los Angeles, and that puts it at about one person in every 100 gets in a traffic accident every year, so you are significantly overrepresented. Unless you have 200 people in your immediate family.
I hope my wife is watching this because she just backed into my car yesterday. Second thing is, so have you made a determination of what next year will be, the year of...
Well, I think that one of the primary initiatives that we'll be talking about next year is domestic violence. I mean, domestic violence is an issue which showed a significant increase, particularly in some of our communities last year. An increase in domestic violence, you know, domestic violence is a hugely underreported crime. Even the best estimates are that domestic violence only gets reported one in four times of occurrence. So, you know, an increase in domestic violence reporting is not necessarily an awful thing, but it certainly is something that we need to work on as a city. You know, if people, primarily women, are more likely to come forward and disclose domestic violence or spousal abuse, you know, that's a very positive development. But, you know, we need to look at these things and to make sure that we have adequate, not only resources for them to avail themselves of, and that's a huge thing. Shelters, advocates, people to help them through the system, you know, our domestic violence response teams, all of that needs to be looked at to make sure that it's at least adequate and hopefully more than adequate. And then, you know, we need to continue to push the message out that domestic violence is wrong and that it's a crime and that it is not only a crime that affects the immediate parties involved, but it has huge and lasting effects on the household. And it can be one of the clear predictors of a future brush with the criminal justice system. Future criminality is hugely impacted by kids that see violence in their homes. So, you know, for the wellness of the entire city and for the city's future, it is important that we address domestic violence. And so I think you'll see more focus on that next year. You know, we'll continue to work on aspects of traffic, and I think that we have seen some positive results in that. But I think that we have to shift as we see various trends, and we have seen a significant trend in domestic violence reporting.
Any other questions of the chief, commissioners? Okay.
Okay, we do have one public comment card. We have Mr. Ted Hayes.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Professionalism, thank you, Chief. Tolerance, I don't know what to call it exactly. But something is saying because the face of black protest is becoming more white, there's more tolerance and more acceptance for the behavior of people who are protesting. I don't know, but it's something to be considered. I, for one, am very astonished at the whiteness of black protests. Have you noticed? I see that some of your cadets are here, and I just came from the law library, saw the same outrageous scene. The United States flag, as we see it here now, is supposed to be to the left of every flag. Now, you can burn the flag as a aspect of speech or whatever, but why in every public building do I see the flag? I think the maintenance people do it. Custodial people, they don't know what to do with it. Anyway, Chief, I really would like that you and the commission inspect the MTA's policing of our transit system. The sheriff cannot do the job. They're too thin. They're too lackadaisical. There are too many other things. But the crime and the disturbances on, I'm transit dependent, that's why I know this firsthand. The crime is outrageous on buses, particularly on Crenshaw, Vermont, Western. But the sheriff is too thin or too unconcerned to do anything about it. It's been reported in the media, so it's just not me. I know. Now, once we had it, we mean the LAPD, and it was lost. But only because cops are around every corner can transit be properly policed. Thank you.
Thank you. We're now on item number 3, report of the executive director, Mr. Tiefenk.
Morning, Mr. President, members of the commission. Just very brief housekeeping items. Commission will be dark the next two Tuesdays, December 23rd and December 30th. Our next regular meeting after this meeting will be on January 6th, 2015 at 9:30 a.m. in this room. And as to the regular agenda, item 8C is in Charles, the department's verbal risk management update. Mr. Alacon is stuck in traffic, so he's requested that we just move that item to the last on the agenda. But it will be heard today, just last on the agenda. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Item number 4 on the agenda, the report of the Inspector General, Mr. Bustamante.
Good morning, Commissioners. As you are aware, we had an opening with the aide position in my office. I'm happy to announce that we've filled it. We have Sergeant Jody Steiger, who is the training coordinator in Operation South Bureau and is also a tactics and force instructor for the department. Sergeant Steiger, are you here?
Yeah, there he is.
So we're really lucky to have his expertise, and he's already fully integrated into our team and working with us on projects. A couple updates on some of the community activities that we're currently involved in. This Saturday, we were part of a meeting in South Bureau involving several representatives, both religious and civilian leaders for the various AME churches. We're going to be working together in the coming year on various projects with them. I'll keep the commission posted on that. Yesterday, I met with several individuals regarding our pending SAR report, suspicious activity report, and went through our process and tentative findings. I expect the report to be completed, and to the extent possible, we'll be integrating some of the comments that the community made as far as the requests for additional data or us to break down certain things in a more specific manner so that they have the information in a way that's useful to them. I expect that it'll be out and completed for the commission's review mid-January. And that concludes my report.
Okay, we do have one public comment card. We have Mr. Todd Hayes.
Mr. Hayes, before you comment, will you come up to the podium and help me put the flag in the right place? I just verified that you were correct. So let's do that.
Sir, may I suggest that the color guard do that?
Sure. Come on, guys. So what Mr. Hayes pointed out, which I verified, nothing personal.
It's just protocol. It's not a law.
This flag should be to the left, and it should be a little bit out front of the other flag. Mr. Hayes, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
You better not say anything mean after me. There you go.
Okay.
Mr. Attorney, Inspector General, it's not a CIA torture, but it's a torture nevertheless. And it occurred in two places, at the Metropolitan Detention Center and also at 77th Street. It's beyond a year now since I was arrested and taken to those two locations. And in both instances, I was not fed. Not only that, I was put in isolation. I don't know why. I have suspicions. I have speculation, but I really don't know why. And since I've been to your office on this, IA on this, records on this, both police divisions on this, I've gotten no answer. All I want to know is when and where was I arrested and housed, And why was I put in isolation? And more importantly, why was I not fed? Now, at Metropolitan, when I wasn't fed and the officer, the sergeant wanted to cite me out, I refused to be cited out. I said, I want to go before a judge and tell him how you've been treating me. So that sergeant cleverly put me in a black and white and drove me over to the hospital. And they fed me there. I got on a bus, leaving the hospital, passed out on the bus. When I was at 77th Street, they took me to the traffic court, and I passed out in a cell, and I was taken to the hospital. So this kind of torture can almost be deadly, because I can't govern my head when I strike the concrete floor. I'm unconscious. But I'd like to know from you, sir, why was I placed in segregation? Isolation is what they call it. Well, no, they call it segregation. And why wouldn't they feed me? Because that's torturous.
Thank you, sir.
Commissioner, if I may briefly. Mr. Hayes, if you can link up with Kevin Rogan from my office, I believe. Kevin, can you raise your hand? He'll meet with you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now on item number 5. Item number 5 consists of information items and filed items relative to noise variances and special event permits submitted for the period ending December 12, 2014. Item number 6, presentations. Do we have any presentations?
Not today.
Thank you. Item number 7 is consent agenda items. These items are considered to be routine and non-controversial, upon which the board is provided with adequate information for approval without inquiry or discussion. Would a commissioner wish to pull an item as special for discussion 7A through 7E?
I move approval with thanks to the donors.
Second.
Especially that Mustang.
Right.
We're now on item number 8.
Wait, all those in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Thank you.
Item number 8.
We're now on item number 8, regular agenda items. Item 8A, B, C, and D are verbal presentations. Would a commissioner wish to pull an item as special for discussion 8E through 8J?
I'd be interested in hearing from the department items 8H.
Correct.
And 8I. And I move approval of items 8E, 8F, 8G, and 8J.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Good. Thank you, Rob.
Okay. We'll begin with item number 8A, Department's verbal presentation and discussion relative to the police cadet program and introduction of the new chief cadet.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Members of the Commission, Chief Beck. My name is Natalie Torres. I am the department's youth programs coordinator, working predominantly with the cadet program at this point. And this morning, we just wanted to show you our latest video for our recruitment purposes, showing you some of the things that the cadets do in a fun and exciting manner.
They meditate in a fun manner. That's the first slide.
It says play again.
Where's Maggie when we need her? There we go.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked about a dozen times.
It did. We
believe you. Well, you can lip sync it.
There's no, it's not even coming out.
Cute.
Apologize for the technical difficulties. In addition, I'd like to also introduce some of the cadet commanders that I have.
We'll
with
watch
me.
It the next our next meeting.
Okay.
We'll
send it to you.
Key it up and watch it. Yeah.
Okay, very good.
Okay, thanks.
Can I just say, as someone who spends a fair amount of time standing in front of a group of people as a teacher, nothing is more frustrating to me than what you just experienced. But we all do, and technology is just not as reliable as we'd like it to be. So I look forward to the rest of the presentation, and I look forward to whether we see it as a group or we see it individually. But please don't beat yourself up over it. It happens to every one of us way more often than I wish it would. So, but thank you.
Look what happened to Sony recently. I mean, my God, somebody could have hacked into this thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. So I wanted to introduce two of the commanders here that I have with me. Christine Lopez comes to us from Wilshire Division. And Commander Abel Luis from Hollywood Division. And now I'd like to introduce to the commission our latest chief cadet that was appointed on November 22nd at our graduation, Ms. Laura Mendoza from Hollywood Division.
Hey, Laura, would you give your speech from here?
I'm right there, sir?
Yeah.
Yes.
Come on. How's it feel?
I feel special.
I think you're special.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say good morning, President Sobroff, members of the Police Commission, and Chief Charlie Beck. I am Laura Mendoza, the newest Chief Cadet of the LAPD Cadet Leadership Program. So as I sit here with you, I visualized myself 4 years ago. When I began my journey in this program, I was a shy, very shy, timid 15-year-old then, and the youngest of four children to hardworking Mexican immigrants. I have been born and raised in Hollywood, in an area where youth are often drawn to join gangs and to do drugs. I was a teenager oblivious to what the future had in store for me. Today, however, I, as a result of the support and encouragement that this program has provided me, I am confident and I'm a very goal-driven young woman in charge of my own future. This program has inspired me and many others to achieve academic success. I am extremely proud to say that I graduated from Hollywood High School in 2013 with a 4.1 GPA. And now I attend California State University, Los Angeles, where I still maintain a 4.0 GPA, where I am a communications major, and I have learned leadership, responsibility, and strong character as a result of being in this program. By becoming involved in various community events throughout the city, I have seen firsthand how this community involvement helps build the trust in our communities. This program has transformed many parents' negative perceptions toward the LAPD to more positive ones as a direct result of their child's involvement. Many of these parents have been so grateful for what the program has done for their child and has offered to them that they like to return back to the community, and they actually help out various divisions and stations with toy giveaways. So they're pretty much more involved than they used to be in the past. I truly believe that every young person that is recruited into this program is one less person who will not become involved in gangs, who will not be reluctant to say no to drugs when they are offered some, and who will not become involved in any illegal activities. The goal of this program is not to produce future police officers, although we do encourage the LAPD as a career path. I mean, it's the best job to be a police officer. But rather, it is to help transform these young people into productive individuals who strive to reach their goals and steer clear of trouble. Now, commissioners, you may be asking yourselves, what more can you do to help? Well, our next Cadet Academy is scheduled to begin January 10th of the upcoming year, and I ask that you please continue to help us spread the word to your various communities and encourage every young person that you come across to apply to this program. And should they wonder, is it worth waking up every Saturday morning at 5:30 in the morning, as I often did, the answer is absolutely. It absolutely is worth waking up that early every Saturday morning. I owe my success to this program. This cadet leadership program has provided me with the belief that my life was what I decided to make of it, that nothing was beyond my reach, that as long as I was willing to dream big, work hard, and stay focused, anything was possible. I would like to thank all the police officers, cadet advisors, and fellow cadets who helped me to be better and who have been instrumental in my success. So thank you, and I would love to answer any questions that you may have at this time.
I have one. Miles, will you stand up for a second? My son is here, and I wondered if 5 years from now you would marry him.
Be gone.
He'd be a great daughter-in-law.
Thank you.
Say no.
You got 5 years. Any other questions?
I have a question. I'm wondering if I've spoken to Chief Paysinger about this a few times. And, you know, I'm one of those people who I'm like a dog with a bone. So I have a belief that if there were alumni clubs of the cadets at the various area colleges, do you think that that would probably be more give you even more support once you graduate from high school? Do you think that's a good idea or just a dumb idea?
I think it's a good idea. I think it's a very good idea. I mean, the more support that we have, the more that we can help each other out. The more you have support groups, it just helps you out.
So. And what do you think it would take to start forming such an alumni organization?
Just a little bit of planning. A little bit of planning is all it takes.
So I don't know how to help in that, other than I'd say that I would like to donate up to $1,000 to help finance any of the meetings or planning schedule or any of that in order to make that happen. I am a great believer.
Thank you.
I thank you. I thank all of you. So you were going for me and the commissioners to do a challenge? So we can, you know, we can talk about this privately, but I just threw in the first 1,000.
Very nice.
Very nice.
I don't have a question, but I do have a comment. I think I'm the only commissioner who was here when this particular iteration of the department's youth program was created, the cadets program, to replace the explorers. And there was some controversy having to do with that decision, and there were some in the department and outside who thought that the department would not be successful in its efforts to replicate, replace the Explorer program. And I just, every time we have a presentation like this, every time I go to a graduation or a beginning ceremony, every time I see cadets at a particular event, and since I live in the Hollywood area, I'm particularly well protected. I just am so impressed with everything you've done, you cadets and the department, its ability to take this program and use it so successfully as a core of community policing. And I just, my hat is off to you, all of the cadets and to the department for this tremendous amount of work. I thank you very much.
Chief Paysinger, would you give a few comments? You're the father of this program, and of how many cadets? You're the, I guess, daddy of how many? 7,000.
First of all, I mentioned to Chief Beck just last evening that today marks my 40th year with the LAPD, having started in December 16th, 1974, as a police student worker. And as a matter of fact, I think the chief started about the same time. So we're celebrating our 40th year together. Give the chief a big round.
Like 100.
Together.
Right.
This has been an amazing journey for the department's outreach to community youth and community development. Commissioner Saltzman was right. When we first began, I believe it was 2007 during the transition, and in 2010 when the transition actually occurred, there were some who were very doubtful whether or not the LAPD could make that transition. And I'm very proud to say that with a hard work of scores of sworn and civilian members of the LAPD, my partner Natalie Torres, I often say that I'm just a pretty face that helps to raise the money. She has been remarkable. She's been extraordinary in terms of bringing the program together, all of its elements. It has been a marvelous opportunity for the department to prove what it can do in terms of community policing. Sometimes we struggle understanding what that means. Well, what that means is what you see. The young people, so capable, so smart, so intelligent, crystal clear about what their future is. And I think the LAPD and the members of this community could do well by modeling after them. And not only the cadet program. As a matter of fact, I was just talking to somebody this morning, about the Watts Bears in Southeast and the amazing work that is being done, not only to transform the lives of those young people with their football equipment, but really transforming a community. Because these youth programs, that's what this is all about. This is about transforming their lives in the communities we serve. And so it's been an extraordinary opportunity, an extraordinary circumstance, and I got to tell you, it's changed my life just as it has theirs. So thank you.
Okay, we are now on item 8B, Department's verbal and video presentation with discussion relative to the Police Community Partnership Program.
Do a photograph with you other. And here's a little link for you.
Oh, thank you.
I have no idea. I wasn't prepared. I'm sure they have one somewhere.
You go?
Somebody's got to have an iPhone with every.
You guys want to come up for the
Courtney, I'll show
Rob?
Chief.
Carlos, you.
Money shot.
$248. You good to go?
Okay. One more.
He's an attorney, so.
So the picture will be great, but we won't get it for 2 weeks.
It'll be great. It'll be great.
Okay. Congrats.
Tammy.
It's hilarious.
Thank you for some time.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Mr. President, I've been told we fixed the technological glitch, so we'll play the video real quick before we do Captain Tangredi's presentation. You can still stay there, sir, don't it?
We're on schedule.
Yes.
Good morning.
By the way, because I'm happy, come along if you feel like a woman.
happens to you, don't waste your time. Here's why. Because I'm happy. I'm alone. If you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy. I'm alone. If you feel like happiness is the truth. Because I'm happy. I'm alone. If you know what happiness is to you. Because I'm happy. I'm alone. If you feel like that's what you want to do.
Mr. President, if I could just make one final comment, it's a personal comment to Chief Peck. The change from the Explorers to the Cadet program would not have happened but for Chief Peck's willingness to make that decision. Chief Bratton, for whom I have great respect, did not favor that change. And one of the first things Chief Peck made clear when he became chief was that this change will be made. And I hope you are as pleased with the results of this as I am. And I'm just so proud to have had a role in it. And I want to thank you for your leadership on this issue.
Good point. Thank you, sir.
Okay, we're now on item 8B, Department's verbal and video presentation with discussion relative to the Police Community Partnership Program and the Watts Bear Pop Warner football team.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Phil Tingerini, the commanding officer of Southeast Area, and I'd like to introduce the Sergeant Amata Tingerini, who is the Community Safety Partnership Coordinator, Cornell Marshall, who is one of our absolutely amazing community volunteers, which is really the point of this whole program, is to get this to where we have community members running it. Zarin Thompson, who is the head coach of the Bears. James Holloman, Officer Grant Gooseby, and Officer James Kelly, who are all coaches to the Bears. And so at this point, we'll go ahead and play the special that was done on Brian Gumbel Sports on HBO.
Los Angeles neighborhood, it's had little to cheer for far too long. The neighborhood is Watts, and it came to national attention nearly 50 years ago when furious race riots there resulted in widespread destruction and 34 deaths. Since then, Watts has been trapped in a cycle of poverty, crime, and gang warfare, and every attempt to stop it has failed. But a new program that emphasizes cooperation between police and the residents of Watts is showing surprising promise. As Carl Quintanilla reports, it's a program built largely around football.
Let's go on a hop, let's go! Bring it out!
Ah!
Helmet!
It may look like any youth football team in any city in the country, but in truth, it's unlike any that has ever existed.
Knees up, hit.
Because the people on this field represent two sides in a long and painful war.
What do we want? Justice! What do we want now?
The war between African American communities and the police. Today, it's erupting in Ferguson, Missouri. But it began in earnest 50 years ago in the Los Angeles community of Watts, which rioted against the LAPD in 1965, leaving 34 dead and a community in ruins. Ever since, Watts has been the picture of urban dysfunction, racked by poverty and gang violence. Part of the problem, a population that, like in many inner cities, so distrusts the police that few will cooperate with them, preferring instead to see crimes go unsolved.
Right, man.
But this is Watts today.
We're going to come out physical. We're coming out fast. Red Bull, you going to the 3. Jordan going to the 4. You guys with me on this?
Yes!
And these are the Watts Bears. Not so much a football team as an experiment.
Good job.
A team of boys from the inner city and a coaching staff entirely made up of LAPD cops.
Who has it better than us?
No!
Sports brings people together. I don't care where you're from. You know, you like sports, yeah, I like sports. Hey, let's do this. Check in, check in, check in.
Officer Zarin Thompson is the head coach. His players, 9 to 11-year-old boys, whose parents and grandparents' generation staged the most notorious anti-police riots in U.S. history. Not just the Watts riots in the 60s, but the L.A. riots in the 90s, when the Rodney King beating led to protests, violence, and a city on fire.
The fact that they're letting their kid be around you.
Be around me as an officer, correct.
That's progress.
Oh yeah, big time.
You're having to undo decades of mistrust.
And you're trying to do that, like, right now. And it's tough.
In fact, when Thompson first started putting the team together 3 years ago, walking these streets to recruit kids, he was typically told to keep walking.
We tell him it's a free program. We're going to suit your kid up from head to toe. No. You're the police? Yes. He can't play with you. My kids are taught not to trust the police. Period.
There was no humanizing on either side.
Philip Tingarides is a captain with the LAPD.
The police looked at everybody in this community as if they were a thug and a gang member, and the community looked at the police department as people who were in power with and treated them with disrespect.
And if you grew up with that, you don't forget that.
It's a norm. That's just what it is and how it is.
Tingarides and his partner have seen it with their own eyes for 2 decades here in Watts, home to some of the country's most gang-ridden housing complexes, like Jordan Downs.
Across the street right here, LAPD and Jordan Downs had an office, and it got firebombed. I believe that happened 2 times.
The 2 cops were convinced there had to be a better way. After all, she was a young black woman from Watts, and he was an older white cop who started his career fighting gangs here. And they were able to get along, and then some. Falling in love and getting married. Soon after, Phil and Amata Tingarides helped conceive a plan, what they call the Community Safety Partnership, or CSP, a select team of 46 LAPD cops who would try to engage with the community, not antagonize them.
So our first month, it came back with some frustration. You know, Sarge, how are we going to do this? It's impossible. The adults don't want to talk to us. So he said, let's start with the youth. Because if we can work with the youth, then hopefully we'll eventually get to the parent.
3-point stance, let's go! Ready!
Which is why the Watts Bears were formed.
Get down there!
A football team with their own field, uniforms, and most importantly, coaches. All cops with the CSP program.
What's up, fellas?
And when they're not bonding with the kids on the field, they're rubbing elbows with folks around town.
So what you got?
Their sole job is to connect with the community and create a dialogue. They rarely, if ever, make arrests for petty crimes. And they spend their days hanging out in the housing developments here, rather than only coming in to respond to a shooting, like in years past.
You staying out of trouble?
You see I stopped at the stop sign, right? We're like a liaison to the community, to the department. We're handling issues up front. You know, concerns. Getting that trust to lean our way.
Part of that, Thompson says, is assuming a fatherly role in a community where young boys often need support. He knows. He grew up here as one of them.
You know what I promised you, right? What?
Football helmet.
Okay. When I get the report card.
Thompson still can't shake the memory of a rainy day 7 years ago when a radio call summoned him to a local park.
Possible abandoned baby. And I'm going, nowhere in the hell. Sure enough, there's a baby in the car seat. And so I walked over, pulled the little blanket back, and there he was, sitting there. He's soaking wet.
There's clearly no parent.
There's no one. There's no one there. So, you know, you go home with that, and wow, it's tough.
Many kids in Watts grow up in need of help. And the boys on the Bears are no exception. 11-year-old Ricky Jubert has no father anymore. He was murdered a year ago. Ricky says playing on the Bears gives him an outlet and an alternative to seeking revenge.
I could take all the anger out and stuff to play football since my dad passed.
You're angry?
Yes.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
Be a football player.
Really? Professional?
Yes, if I don't want to be a football player, I guess I'll just be an officer, a police officer.
Another boy, Jermel McKnight, badly wanted to play football but had nowhere to do it until the LAPD formed the Bears. He jumped at the chance. But Annie McKnight, Jermel's adoptive mother, says it took some getting used to.
What do you think of him hanging around with police? I mean, some of these parents had to learn how to trust the police.
Yeah, a lot of them did. Because when we first got there, they had told us, well, you guys can leave. You don't have to sit here and wait. And we was like, we don't know you. I'm leaving my kid with you. Because at first, you wouldn't even think to trust the police.
But one by one, the boys of Watts have come out to play for the Bears. Now, boys from all three of the neighborhood's public housing complexes, each run by rival gangs, are playing together on the same team.
Explain to me why that's important.
The neighborhoods don't associate with each other. And so my dad was a gang member at this development, and your uncle was a gang member at this development, or your uncle shot my dad, so we can't merge, we can't talk. So breaking that barrier was tough.
Now, boys who live in enemy territories, boys who have always been taught to never even be seen near the cops, are picked up in police vans and driven together to practice.
Door-to-door service. Yeah. LAPD. Here he is right here. All right, let's get in the van, man.
Many of these kids are now staying out of trouble and doing better in school, like Jermel McKnight.
Has being on the Bears changed your life?
A little.
A little? How has it changed it?
I used to get in trouble a lot, but now I don't.
He was really wow. And he was fighting a lot.
There was a wild streak to him.
There was a wild streak, and we had to calm it down.
How much do you think football changed that?
I think it helped a lot.
Annie McKnight isn't the only parent to have started buying into the program. The quarterback's dad, Andre Bradley, says it's strange that the same people he'd expect to be harassed by are now his kids' mentors.
Is it weird being around the police like this? Does that feel different?
Of course. I'm just getting bothered by them. You know, putting handcuffs on. I understand what's going on. I see what's going on. I don't mind. Yeah.
It's like a domino effect. And then one guy goes, hey, man, you know, the guy might be okay. Oh, yeah, man, I talked to Thompson. I talked to such and such. He's an all right guy.
Is the trust factor higher now than it ever has been?
Yes, this thing is working big time.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7!
And when the Bears play, Captain and Sergeant Tingarides, the husband and wife team who run the Community Safety Partnership, are often on hand to root them on. After all, just 3 years after they launched the program, there appears to be much to cheer about.
There were 79 homicides in these developments from 2001 until CSP began. And then you went almost 2 years without any homicides at all.
That is correct.
And the four homicides that we had were all solved within 2 weeks because people who had relationships with officers were calling them and telling the officers what was going on, who was involved. Because everybody knows. They're all there. People talk. But they weren't talking to us. But how much of all of that do you think is due to the Bears? What do you say to people who are like, it's a game?
Well, for us it's a game, but it's really a tool to bring trust between the police and the community. They're giving us their kids. And we're taking their kids, we're keeping them safe. And over time, we saw the shift from some really bad words, and I don't even want to look at you, to hey, to all right, to a conversation. They humanized us, we humanized them. It's really hard once you humanize somebody to have a dysfunctional relationship.
The Bears didn't have a winning record this season, but for Coach Thompson, who saved that baby deserted in the park years ago, the real victory is to truly protect and serve Watts' next generation, so the future will be different from the past. He was reminded that again at a Bears practice a few months back by Annie McKnight, the woman who adopted Jermell after he was abandoned years ago.
She started telling somebody about the story how Jermell was found. And then she's like, yeah, man, his mom left him out on a corner by her park and it was raining and in a car seat. I go, Annie, man, I'm the officer who found that kid.
He said, you mean tell me this boy been under my nose for 2 years and we didn't know it. And I'm like, thank you. Because here we are again.
I'm back in this guy's life as a mentor, as a coach, as a friend.
Jermell, you need to run with the ball. Let's go, buddy.
Saving him again.
Saving Jermell again.
Carl, since it's money that makes the world go round, how is this football program funded? Is this part of Community Safety Partnership? Is it under that umbrella? It's actually a grant from the LA Housing Authority, $5 million for 5 years, expires in 2016, and the hope is that they'll renew it. We don't know. The kids who get to play, just open sign-up, so they have to qualify. Well, you wanna play, you can play. Of course, part of the challenge is getting these kids and their parents to trust the police enough to let them. Is there an educational component to this, that the kids have to make certain grades in order to qualified? The cops will go to parent-teacher conferences. I mean, they are involved in these kids' lives beyond anything I expected. But it's not just football. There's a Girl Scout troop, and there's a dance club. There's a track for the off-season. So they're trying to find ways, not just in football, but keep them involved. Do the kids ever see their coaches in cop uniforms? Part of the plan is to see them in what they call soft tactical, short sleeves, no visible guns, so you don't look like what you thought the police are supposed to look like. I noticed that none of the coaches were white. Would that be asking a little too much? Is that too much too soon of this program? That's probably a little ambitious. You want people who know what it's like to grow up in these neighborhoods because they were these kids once.
Great program.
Can you talk about what it's like growing up in this neighborhood?
You know what? I lived here almost 47 years. I grew up here. Watched a lot of my friends lose their life, a lot of them go to prison. In 2005, the end of 2005, we had 7 young men lost their life right here.
In 1 year?
And within 2 months.
Within 2 months?
Yes, and it was heartbreaking. We didn't even have a relationship with LAPD at all. The communication was totally them versus us, we versus them.
Did you think to yourself, that's never gonna work? The football idea.
Well, you know, myself, when a good idea come up, I never say never, but I did know it was going to be a challenge. You got to imagine, you at war. A lot of you guys follow wars. When the wars in the streets is similar to the wars overseas, you had guys that might have killed your brother, might have shot your cousin. The relationship have changed tremendously with LAPD. During the time when we first started working on this wall, we had a lot of young people lost their lives to gang violence. So we said, well, let's make this be the mirror to the community. And as you see down the wall, we was almost running out of space.
Mm-hmm. When's the last time you had to write a name up here due to gang violence?
You know what? It's been a while. I would say maybe right now 3 years.
I bet you never thought you'd go that long.
We did.
First heard about it, this idea of a football team, did it immediately strike you that it would work?
Not that it would work. I knew we'd have challenges because we're taking, you know, kids from different gang rivals and different environments and trying to bring them to one.
How does this match with what you saw in your head?
Actually, this is better than what I expected. Better than what I thought. You know, this is the first year we actually have kids from all 3 developments, and it's not just that. I can look up in the stands and see parents from all 3 developments. That I think that's bigger than this.
Parents who, I don't know, hated each other since they were kids, right? Are they sitting together too, or is this?
They're sitting together. They leave everything behind because they see it's for the kids. So they get it too. You know, we all wear, you know, blue, white, and orange. We're all Watson Bears. We're all one team.
Tell me about the coaches. What role do they play in your life?
No, the coaches is like one of the biggest roles in my life. Is to me, God, school, my parents, and my coaches.
Do you think of them as coaches or police officers?
No, I think of them as, they like one of my parents. They like my dad, all of my dad, and they teach me right from wrong, and they teach me how to stay disciplined, and they teach me what to do and what not to do.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be a rapper, rather a famous rapper or a famous football player.
Can you do a rap right now?
Yes, I can.
Let's hear one.
Okay. My name is Baby Dre and I'm out for the pay. So all you good people, listen to what I gotta say. See, I'm out for this bread. I'm trying to get fed like Lil Wayne said. I'ma pick the word up and I'ma drop it on your head and I'ma poop it out on your girlfriend just because I'm way out. Way out of the hood, way out of the violent side. How you people in silence, cause I'm wild finest. So get behind this, I'll kill you with kindness. The brand like mine, your time is so bad. Down to your honey. I'm like a shooting star, rising and shining. And when I rhyme it, just do as I say, like Simon.
Oh, that's good.
So nice.
I would assume that we're here to answer for their losing record this season.
We just want to know where to get season tickets.
Oh.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What do you guys want to say? You got to be so proud. No question. What do you want?
A couple things I would like to say.
When you look at today's America and what's going on right now, and then you look back at this, how do you feel?
It's kind of breathtaking for me because Ahmad and I have been answering media requests very, very literally from all over the world, asking us what we're doing. We had one of the major news media from the Netherlands with us the other night when we were out on the sled giving out candy throughout the community, and when we went to the Watts snow day. We have a request from Zimbabwe to come and see. I mean, it's just incredible. But I would like to give Amada and Carnell just a second to make a couple of comments, because they're the ones that are the big heart of this.
Good morning. I really actually want to thank Chief Beck for allowing the department to dedicate police resources to a community that has historically been left behind. And to take those police resources and truly dedicate them, not just on paper, but to allow us to go into a community and undo so much trauma and historical hatred, and to give us the time to do it, because it takes time. The CSP program is 3 years old, and I've asked the officers assigned to this program to go in and do the best that they can, but to do it with passion and compassion, and police with an understanding of the community that we're serving. So I feel extremely blessed and grateful that the police resources that we've dedicated to this program within our third year will continue. And Chief Beck just approved us to expand the program into Avalon and Gonzac.
Wow.
And to extend it until December of 2019. My hope is that eventually we get enough police resources to be in all 14 public housing developments in the city. And if you can reduce and eradicate crime in some of the lowest socioeconomic communities, we can change the culture of policing. We're not only changing a community, but the community is changing the culture of the police officer. And if we can create a division on LAPD with this CSP program, and we can work outside of these public housing developments to bring the community together, because that's what we're seeing, then we've changed the history, and it's going to take time. So thank you, Chief Beck, for allowing us to do this. These officers that are assigned to this program work with their heart, their soul, and to have a community member sit side by side with me in a police commission meeting who doesn't get paid, who sees the work that we're doing, and is going to lock arms with me and work in this community is something I never thought I'd see in my 20 years on this police department. So because of you and the honesty and the willingness to work with law enforcement, this is successful. And we would not be able to do it without the community standing behind us. So thank you. Thank you, Chief Beck.
Good morning, everyone. I'm actually an LAPD Explorer alumni from Southeast.
For you.
I'll be real fast. This program is an awesome program. I mean, there's can't say too much, you know, too much about it. From the officers showing up to the schools, grades has improved. And I want to correct one thing. The Watts Bears were actually the Pop Warner D3 champions this year for L.A. County. We're one game away from state. So one game away. So without the officers, and it's going to take a lot of support from the community, and we're getting there a lot. And I appreciate you guys having us here today.
Thank you.
I have a question.
No, you were the star of the show. Give him the microphone.
Just wanted to say thank you and the support from LAPD. Without the support from the department, this thing wouldn't work. So thanks again from all the coaches.
Commissioner Madison?
I do have a question because there's a part of this that certainly is bridging a lot of historic distance. But I wonder, will there come a time when the children and their parents will see the officers in uniforms? Because somewhere in here, having them, according to at least the story, they don't really see the coaches that way. But if we're going to truly bridge that gap, at some point, there just has to be, I think, the introduction to the reality that these are police and police do good also.
Yes, ma'am. Actually, that was kind of misstated in the filming. We placed the officers in a soft clothes uniform. As you can see, they wear polo shirts, bike shorts. When we go out in the community, we play softball games, we play basketball. We do have officers outside of uniform. We encourage them to wear the CSP uniform. When we have formal events, we are in our Class A's. And the officers, the youth know that we are police officers. When they see us in our formal uniforms, they say, why are you wearing that? Where's your CSP LAPD uniform? They recognize the difference.
I have to say that I think that the soft uniform that they wear, it presents the police department very differently. I think in South LA, this uniform is almost offensive to a lot of folks in that community. And so I think that this was a big step in breaking down an actual barrier.
I mean, I completely see that, and I certainly am not suggesting at the outset that, you know, you'd go in and full. If that's a soft uniform, I don't know if this is the hard uniform. I don't know what. but what I'm getting at is especially like when we look at the cadets, right? We look at the cadets, and you see that they're wearing uniforms that are soft and somewhat mimic an official policing attire. So I'm only when I'm. I guess what I'm just getting at here is that at some point, the ability to have the transition, not that you all would come out of the polo shirts and all, but that they recognize that this too is the LAPD. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner?
Yeah, in my normal life, I work with youth, so I get the challenges, and when I saw the video not too long ago, it's really heartfelt, the work that you've been able to do and the reconnection that you had. I noticed in the football and the Bears, you had one girl. What are we doing about girls in Watts? And I know you have other programs. And then just a statement to the media who's here, because, and I'm hoping that you report on the great cadet program that we have and what's going on in Watts, because tomorrow I'd like to open up the paper and see the great things this police department does in communities.
Thank you.
That was actually a male. He just has long hair.
That's
Red
Steven.
Bull. I got to tell him that.
That's Steven.
But we also have a lot of programs for the female youth. I won't tell him.
How many cameras? 1, 2, 3, 4.
We have our Watts Girl Scouts troop, which we started 3 years ago at Grape Street Elementary. This year we're adding 3 more schools on. Florence Griffith Joyner, which is right across the street from
Jordan Downs, 112th Street Elementary School. And we're actually now transitioning into the middle schools, and we're going to try a Girl Scout troop at Gompers Middle School, which is one of our most troubling middle schools in Watts. We also were busing youth and coordinating with the National Guard, and we're sending kids to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We've created over 20 youth programs with CSP, and we're looking at scaling back on some so we can have a better balance with our critical enforcement and relationship-based policing.
And we also have track. So we also have track. So that's where a lot of our female athletes participate. I have my own daughters participate in that particular program.
Great.
Okay. Wonderful.
Thank you very much for all you do. Miles, thanks for bringing it to my attention.
Well, I have a question, actually.
Yeah.
First of all, I grew up spending a lot of time in Watts. Sweet Alice Harris is grandson of my best friend. So I spent a lot of time on Blue Hill and my grandson. I know a lot of kids who've gone the right way and the wrong way. So I saw it on TV and proudly pointed it out to my dad. And just wanted to say thank you to you guys for doing what you do in this community. It's important to my family, too. My question is a simple one. What can civilians like myself do to support the program?
Do you have 20 minutes?
My email.
That, I would love your email. We do need support. There are a lot of dysfunctional programs that go on in our community, and we're looking at creating a board of representatives to help. Eventually, we want to be able to turn this over to the community. This is about sustainability. LAPD can't coach kids for the next 10 years. We want to be able to hand a functional community where folks can walk within a community, not have fear. Children can actually go and sign up for a structured program. So one of the things we're looking to do is start a Watts Bears Youth League, a 501c3. We have a board, we have a coordinator, and the officers can go back and walk their foot beats and do what we really should be doing, which is reducing the fear in the communities and building relationships. So your email would be great. You're going to have your work cut out for you, and I really appreciate it. Very good.
Thank you very much.
We do have one public comment card. We have Mr. Ted Hayes.
The ruins of the Roman Colosseum let us know that gladiator sports have been with society forever. What I would like to suggest to you is a book called Darwin's Athletes, written by an author who indicates that black athletes and black people and society concentrate on black athletes far too much beyond what is necessary for black people. Crenshaw High School lost its accreditation. What that meant is that the diploma those students got wasn't worth the paper it was written on. Inglewood, a predominantly black city, students who graduated from there and went to college sued the Inglewood school district because they said they were not adequately prepared to go to college and compete. What black people need to concentrate on is intellectualism, education. That is the substance of elevating black people. This program is okay. Do it all you want. I'm not concerned about that. I'm only concerned about the fact is its emphasis on the black athlete and you singing the amount of crime they've been involved in. The chief talked about that domestic abuse, and it's highlighted by black athletes. So I don't know whether athletics develop character, value, a sense of order in society. I don't believe that it does. And you don't either. What is necessary is some kind of a program that will enhance that. And I don't think it's going to be a program where we think God is watching. That doesn't seem to work. We have communities in the black community have churches door to door to door. I go to a Wednesday meeting every Wednesday where the group called Cry No More and Ceasefire. Blacks killing blacks. That's the concern. So athleticism, look at Darwin's Athletes. That's a very good book about the athleticism of black people.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Thanks,
thanks, everybody. Happy holidays.
Okay, we're now on item 8C, Department's verbal presentation and discussion relative to the current status of the risk management program. Welcome, Arf.
How's that drive-in, Arf?
The drive-in was nice.
Plenty of time to think.
Quite a bit of time. As I normally do, I actually got here at about 6:30 in the morning to prepare and do some other stuff. I realized I was missing an essential item of clothing, and so I had to return home. So I had a lot of time to think. But thank you for your patience. And if just one moment, I will get this up.
Curious minds want to know. I mean, there's a Ross store right over there.
I didn't think they'd have my size, but thank you. good morning, commissioners. As you know, my name is Arif Ali Khan. I'm the Special Assistant for Constitutional Policing. I'm also the designated Department Risk Manager, and I'm here today to give an overview of and a follow-up to a presentation I gave several months ago about the department's different approach, new approach, into dealing with risk issues in a variety of areas. Before I begin, however, to give this overview, I did want to introduce a new member of the risk management team for the Los Angeles Police Department, Michael Himes, who's in the back there. Mike Himes was recently appointed by the chief as the new commanding officer of what will be called the risk management group. Chief Himes right now is an assistant chief at the Los Angeles World Airports Police Division, where he's been assistant chief of operations. Also served as the interim chief and worked very closely with me during my time there. He also has a unique background, a mixture of both law enforcement experience, but has also been an attorney for the last 20 years, focusing on police-related issues, including employment-related litigation, criminal matters, things of that nature, and also has a PhD in psychology with a particular focus on law enforcement related issues. He was for a brief time with the Office of the Inspector General here at LAPD and left that position after a short time because he had a great opportunity to be the Director of Security and oversee the legal attorneys for the Orange County Superior Court. So he has a unique perspective on the court system and managing attorneys there. And having been a manager of attorneys in the past, I can tell you that's not an easy feat. So I did want to introduce him, and he will be joining the department as a police administrator too, beginning January 12th. He'll be reporting directly to me, and as I'll mention in a few minutes, he will be a key part of our realignment to address risk management issues. Commissioners, what I plan to do today is give you an overview of where we are on developing our risk management strategy and also give you a perspective that's a little bit different than what I presented some months ago when I first started. Since that time, we have done quite a bit of research into different strategies to deal with risk management, both within law enforcement and outside of law enforcement, within different disciplines, consulting with academics, experts, those who've actually implemented and did quite a bit of research. And what we've come with is that if you look at the literature, if you look at what's being done, risk management tends to be, in its existing forms, very overly broad, tends to be unfocused and complex. And that's always a hard beginning when you look at trying to do something in a complex organization of 13,000 people like the Los Angeles Police Department. As a result, it often is difficult to communicate the concepts. It's difficult to comprehend by the employees who are essential to dealing with these issues. And it tends to be very focused on litigation. Not that litigation should be ignored, but really looking at litigation and solutions to how litigation is handled as a way to mitigate risk and mitigate costs. One major aspect of it as well is it doesn't take into account the inherent risks and dangers of policing. And I think, as I mentioned before several months ago, to talk about how we want to manage risk or avoid risk And you say that to police officers who we actually expect to take risks that many of us would never take is an inherent conflict. And a shift is necessary in order to really incorporate and integrate the ideas of managing risk within a police agency. This is just an example of the complications of typical risk management frameworks. This is from the International Standards Organization. It's a diagram of how a risk management framework should be designed across different disciplines. At some point, if any of you can figure this out for me, I'd appreciate it. But it is an example of taking what are the traditional risk management frameworks would not be something, in my opinion, my team's opinion, easily implementable within the LAPD. So instead, what we have learned from discussions with the various experts and also actually doing things to manage risk within the LAPD since I've been here is to really shift the framework from focusing on sort of future probabilistic risk that you have to manage and really looking at what are we actually trying to reduce? What harm, what injury are we trying to reduce? Risk tends to be about the calculation of the probability of something happening in the future that may or may not happen. We know that there are injuries and harms that are occurring every day and have, especially within recent memory. And implementing specific solutions to try to reduce those harms, specific things to try to reduce injuries so we can yield a benefit in the very short term, and then measuring what those reductions are to know that they've actually been effective. Because there are many comprehensive things we can do. We could go back and try to implement that system in the chart, but whether it's actually working would be very difficult to discern. This is basically a focus of a work that's been done by Malcolm Sparrow, that are mentioned in his book, The Character of Harms. Dr. Sparrow is a former UK police officer who teaches at the Harvard Kennedy School and is an expert on regulatory compliance. Much of his work is focused on regulatory compliance, especially in areas that deal with reducing harms. And he is the one who sort of prompted me to sort of shift in how we're looking at risk management and how we can actually operationalize it within the LAPD. So what type of harms do we actually want to reduce? What are we talking about when we do this? If you look at, there are many different types of injuries that can happen to an organization or an individual, but it really boils down to three things of concern to us. The first is a physical injury. A physical injury to either one of our employees or a member of the public. And there are many ways that could happen. That could be from a traffic collision that results in injuries. It could be from a use of force. It could be from a pursuit, foot pursuit, and a variety of other activities that police are commonly and we expect them to engage in. The second type of injury we want to look at is organizational. And what I mean by organizational, it's actually twofold. It could be the organization itself, its reputation, its ability to build public trust, its ability to have to be seen as a professional organization. And then, of course, operationally, when we have officers who are injured, they cannot be used to perform the essential mission of the department, which is to protect and serve the public. And those types of injuries can have those effects of limiting deployment options and then, of course, diminishing public trust, which is so critical for effective policing. And then third is the financial injuries that would be to the city and its taxpayers when we have medical costs due to employee-related injuries, litigation costs, and then also equipment costs if we're losing police cars at a high rate and those types of things that are involved. But really focusing on those three types of injuries to determine what areas we really need to focus on. And if a police activity has an impact on two or more of those, that's where we want to focus on. Now, another way to look at this, too, is, of course, the financial costs related to certain types of harms. Excuse me. And if you look at claim and lawsuit payouts over the 5 years, and we've been looking primarily at data from 2009 through 2013, that tends to be the more reliable that we have right now, and obviously we're still in 2014. But if you look at those 5 years, there have been approximately $100 million in claim and lawsuit payouts. And they're roughly split into the three main areas of liability or issues. Police liability, which would be uses of force that result in some sort of judgment or a claim for negligence or violation of federal law. law. Officer-involved traffic collisions, about 25% of the claims and payouts were related to that, and then employment-related litigation that we talked about extensively at the a couple of meetings ago. Now, one thing I should note from this, although the payouts are indicated from 2009 through 2013, that does not mean that the underlying conduct or incident or event occurred during those years. And that is because this is when the city actually paid it out. And typically large payouts tend to be much earlier, because if they're a large verdict, let's say, they're more likely to be appealed, and then other ones that are likely to be appealed, they accumulate additional costs for the costs of appeal, and then the ultimate judgment, interest, etc. And I just mention that because many of our statistics, we sometimes think it correlates with the same year, and generally they do not. So I just want to make that point. So when you look at, okay, if we're trying to prevent physical injury to employees in the public, organizational injury and financial injury, and you look at the data from payouts and the frequency of certain types of events, it really comes down to these four areas of harm, which are uses of force, officer-involved traffic collisions, work-related injuries, and workplace misconduct, which are generally the areas that I had mentioned several months ago. However, one of the problems is that if we use those as very broad areas, it's difficult to design solutions to the specific problems, especially if there's a very focused area that's yielding the most physical injury, the most organizational injury, and the most financial injury. And so what we have done in our team is looking at the statistics and looking at the cases, come up with actual specific areas within those that we really want to focus on. The first being unnecessary uses of force. This is an important distinction because we expect officers to use reasonable force under the circumstances to arrest, apprehend, and also in defense of their life or the life of others. And so for us to say that we want to reduce uses of force would actually be sort of in conflict with what we actually want police officers to do. It really comes to unnecessary, obviously any unlawful or excessive, but also uses of force that may put the officer in particular path of harm, which is why the department and, of course, the commission scrutinizes the tactics that lead up to a use of force, separate and apart from the actual application of use of force in a categorical incident, because it may identify tactics that are being used that either harmed or could harm that officer the next time, and focusing on that. Now, of course, if there's an unnecessary use of force, you have a physical injury to a member of the public, you have organizational injury, it goes to the professionalism of the public trust, and then is more likely to create the financial injury from a lawsuit because of a finding or because it was excessive force, you have a higher probability that there's going to be a city payout because of that. So it's more focused. The officer-involved traffic collisions is the same thing, and I'll make this point more clear for the traffic collisions in just a moment. Work-related injuries. We really want to look at the serious work-related injuries and illnesses, the ones that are costing the city most, the ones that are causing people to be out of work the most, and obviously the ones that are causing the most serious injury, because we do not want our officers and employees to suffer serious injuries, or any injury of that matter, but obviously serious first and foremost. And then the fourth is the workplace misconduct. And really here, it's focused on harassment and discrimination. Now, we don't make a subset of that because there should be no tolerance, and there is no tolerance for harassment and discrimination in the workplace. But it's focused on that as opposed to other, let's say, legal causes of action, because often harassment and discrimination are the core issues that lead to other types of allegations, such as retaliation, etc. So really focusing on that. And that, of course, has a significant organizational and financial injury, not necessarily a direct physical injury, but yet it's still very important for the department and its employees. So what does that mean? We've identified this. So what we want to do is really find specific solutions to reduce those specific measurable harms that cause these injuries, physical, organizational, financial, and focus specifically on solutions that will result in the most significant short and midterm reductions. Because we want to focus basically what I call the tactical harm reduction based on what the data shows. There are many long-term things that we do and should continue to do, but the reality is if we want to make an immediate impact or a short-term impact, we really need to focus on the crux of the problem. Here's an example of, and then, of course, we need to look at the data. This is the data from 2009 through 2013 of officer-involved traffic collisions. And as you can see, there's been a general overall decline since 2009 when we had over 1,000 to 2013 when there's 896. Now, one thing I should mention is this is a good thing, obviously, because it's gone down. But the other thing about what the LAPD does in a traffic collision, so let's say hypothetically, Commissioner, you had a take-home police car and your wife just hypothetically backed into it and caused some damage. Now, if in that
are
case...
Are you doing surveillance on me?
Thank you to City Phone. but let's say just hypothetically that happened. Because there was city property involved and some damage, while it may not rise to the level where you would report it to the DMV or maybe even your insurance, under LAPD policy, you must report that. And the traffic collision statistics within those 896, that type of accident would be reported. You may not have even been in the car. It could have been damage from a car wash. Now, also what would be included is if there was a pursuit and a vehicle crashed or there was a collision with an innocent bystander, those types of things would be included. So the point is that you may see a decline, but let's say we're at 800, let's say 900 traffic collisions, just to round it up, in 2013, and we reduced those by 10%. So we reduced it by 90 traffic collisions. That may be wonderful because we've reduced the overall. But let's say those 90 traffic collisions had absolutely no injuries. We have not reduced the physical injury that occurs, the organizational or the financial, and we really truly won't have that much of an impact other than the overall numbers. And this is true when you look at specifically officer-involved traffic collisions with injury to the public. There are three different types of injuries in our statistics: injury to the public, injury to the driver, and injury to an employee passenger. So this is focused just on injury to the public. And if you look at over these 5 years, we've had three officer-involved traffic collisions resulting in death, 14 of aggravated injury. These are what you hear are the A type. These are serious injuries that may have caused death, but fortunately were prevented from death. And then other visible injuries, which could be bruising, broken bones, etc. And then what we call complained of injuries, where somebody is complaining of injury, maybe it's soreness or other things. When you look at that, there were 571 of those traffic collisions. Only 12% then are the ones with injury. 88% have no injury to the public. So that means it's likely that those, well, obviously there's no physical injury, likely not to have an organizational impact, and certainly less likely to have a financial impact because the injuries, you know, were not manifested there. So when you look at that, then you have to figure out, okay, so we focused it in on 12% of those traffic collisions. And then when you look at those 12%, or about the 571 I mentioned, you're really looking at a very small number. You can see the 2% for aggravated injury and then obviously the deaths, a very small number, again, that are likely to lead, that actually have a physical injury that's significant, an organizational impact, and certainly a financial cost. And so really being able to focus in on those and analyze those and figure out what were the causes and what were the things that we could have done differently will really focus in on that, which would have a greater impact into the injuries we're concerned about. Now, complaint of injuries is a large portion of it, and we would not want to ignore those because complaint of injuries could also result in liability. Just simply because it's not visible at the time of the traffic collision doesn't mean that there could be resulting physical harm and then ultimately other liability. The other thing that's very important, though, when we do this data analysis, which is a very important part of our approach, is are we looking at the right numbers? So what this is we tend to look at total numbers and then compare year to year and the percentage decline and incline. What I asked for in Motor Transport Division, which was very helpful with all of this, was, well, what is our accident rate? When you compare, let's say, accident rate deaths state to state, they do it on a per capita basis, you know, according to the number of people or the number of miles driven. Well, in 2013, to give you an example, and Motor Transport was able to provide us this information, the Los Angeles Police Department in police vehicles drove 53 million miles. 53 million miles in the city, which is an enormous amount. Now, that includes all vehicles from patrol cars to plane vehicles to motorcycles to take-home cars and other emergency vehicles, but an enormous number. And then if you take the total number of all traffic collisions, this is the rate you would get per 100,000 miles. So essentially, 1.67 reported traffic collisions for every 100,000 miles driven by the LAPD. Now, I think, Commissioner, just because I was listening and I'd like to loop back to what you had said, I think you had mentioned that you've had two traffic collisions in your family within the last year. You would exceed the accident rate of the Los Angeles Police Department responding to Code 3 and other calls. And that is pretty remarkable when you consider the high-performance driving that we expect of our officers. Now, that doesn't mean that it's okay, because that is the number, especially if you look at just the injuries, they're going to be much smaller than that, that we really need to drive down. But this collision rate across, rather than a 17% reduction, you actually see a 14%, and that's important because it helps normalize that the number of miles that we've driven each year could vary depending on personnel, etc. So ultimately, with this data, what do we want to do? We really want to focus on the tactical aspects of this and really focus and get operators to figure out what the solutions are. I, as a policymaker, may have some ideas, and they tend to be broader, etc. But the reality is it is the police officer or the accident investigator or the motor officer who are really going to have the real solutions to what goes on today. Not 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but what's going on today. And our focus really wants to be on that. Tactical problem solving for strategic problems, but things that we really want to see if we can implement and get done quickly. So the other analogy that's used, and this is used by Dr. Sparrow, is this idea of knots. A knot is a problem. The first thing is to spot the knots, figure out where they are. We've found larger areas and then more specific areas, for example, injury traffic collisions, employee-involved traffic collisions with injuries. But then where is the problem in there? And the idea of a knot is that you want to untie this knot. You're not going to pull it because that's going to make it tighter and worse. You're going to look at it in different directions. You're going to nudge it. You're going to want different ways to do it. You may have a very big knot, a small knot, etc. But ultimately, you're going to loosen it and hopefully unravel it. And that's the approach that we want to take on very specific problems so we can get that knot in the rope untied. So what we expect is that we want to analyze the available data, determine the root causes, and that there are other systems that we want to implement, including the human factors analysis, which I talked about recently, and other tools that are coming into play, for example, the telematics for various vehicles. That will yield a tremendous amount of information for us to analyze how driving is done, and ways to analyze and to fix it. If a police car is involved in a traffic collision, we'll have much more to learn about that traffic collision from this technology, which will be helpful, and collaborate on potential solutions using experts and operators. We want to determine the appropriate outcome measures, not just output measures. Outcome measures mean reductions in traffic collisions with serious injury, reductions in unnecessary uses of force, and then make sure we're providing the support structure to actually take this different approach. If you look at a protocol in terms of how we do that, we've essentially already done, at this point, the top three, and I haven't gone through all the specific areas just for purposes of time, and they will be detailed in a written report that we will have to the Commission in January. But we basically selected those problems, defined them very specifically, and then the factors that we want to measure the impact. The area that we now need to embark on, which will take the effort of the experts, will be what are the specific solutions, getting them implemented, monitoring them, and then at some point we hope to have that knot unraveled, and so it's just a matter of maintaining it, and then we can take that group and shift to another problem. Because if we try to take on too much, we won't get anything done, and that's the idea of being able to focus. And different ways to unravel that knot could be ways to prevent the harm from occurring, ways to intervene before the harm occurs, and sometimes it's simply mitigating it when the harm occurs. Somebody gets injured in pursuit of a suspect, that's going to happen. So how do we mitigate that injury and get them back to work as quickly as possible through the workers' compensation system, reintegrating them back to be perform the essential duty functions of a police officer, things like that. And so to support this, we can talk about the theory, but we really do have to have structural change to support that. So what we are going to do is actually get operator-level expert problem-solving groups in each of those four areas and focused on that. We want to get people who can actually come up with specific solutions and then keep away from that higher-level policymakers and have them on an executive committee to actually just consider the solutions and help with the implementation rather than being part of that process on the ground level, because we want to encourage very innovative thinking, different approaches, and the creativity that this department has in its employees. As I mentioned, Mike Himes will be the commanding officer of the risk management group that will be within my bureau, and we'll be taking the existing legal affairs division and then also the creation of another division with the resources we have, calling it the risk management coordination division. Within that, it'll have two very important units that will be different than the way it's structured now. One is an implementation unit. Detectives who are specifically assigned to each of those four areas of concentration and who will be the ones driving forward the collaboration, the implementation of the solutions we're talking about. And they will be supported by the staff I have who have analytical capability to both provide the data, and we have quite a bit of data compiled already, and also conduct evaluations of whether the solutions are working. And then Chief Pasinger has offered, and the chief has approved, actually having someone designated in all 21 of the geographic areas as a risk management coordinator. That is an important part of this because we do not want to have this approach just be centralized within my bureau. This is something that has to be integrated throughout the department about reducing harm to our officers and to the public. And by having people designated in the areas, that could be our conduit, our connection, making sure we're getting information, pushing it out, and doing that. Now, ultimately, we'd want to expand that to the other divisions, especially the other field divisions, but right now we think 21 areas would be a great start, and we would be training and coordinating with them on a regular basis. The reason why I personally think that this approach would work better than some of the general approaches is because it's completely consistent with the mission of the Los Angeles Police Department and the culture of the Los Angeles Police Department. As an outsider coming in, I have a lot of observations, and I'll talk about one of them in a second, but the whole purpose of policing is to reduce harm. It is about protecting people, serving the public, reducing crime, reducing harm to the community. That's exactly what we're trying to talk about here. We want to reduce harm that occurs to the public through some activities that we want to minimize, and then also injuries to our own officers. Second, the emphasis on community policing is about problem solving. It's about collaborating with the community and coming up with creative ways to deal with specific problems in the neighborhood. That's exactly the approach we want to take here. And then, of course, the reputation of the LAPD as the most professional law enforcement agency in the world, and also the tactical excellence. I joke with my colleagues that in the LAPD, because of its emphasis on tactical excellence, that as long as I say tactical before anything else, everybody will listen to me. And that tends to be true, and you can see that in the language that we use, tactical seatbelt release. You know, you and I may just think about that's the way you take your seatbelt off, but if you say tactical, there's a lot more attention paid to it. This is really about tactical precision, tactical expertise, which is the hallmark of the department, and is an effort to use that to focus in and solve important problems that we have. So just in summary, this is the approach. Focus on these four areas of harm that are very specific within them. Any of these things, because they cause physical, organizational, or financial injuries, have specific solutions to those specific problems, and then measure the impacts. There will be challenges, of course, and I want to say that up front. Resource constraints are always a challenge, but that's why I think this focused approach that we look at specific problems and then move on will be very important. Our analytical capabilities are limited. I'm very fortunate to have a few people on my staff who are very good with the numbers and very good getting the data, and especially getting the data that may not be automated. But trying to get that and making sure that we keep that on a routine basis will be important because we need to measure it as we go along. We have to be willing to try new things and accept that sometimes they won't work and that they will fail. That has to be something none of us like doing, but if we really want to try a new approach, I think that's something that as an organization we need to be able to accept. And then we have to be willing to focus on the tactical solutions to larger strategic problems. So, for example, we have quite a bit of emphasis on wellness programs, which is important because that has a long-term impact. But if we're finding that the specific injuries that officers are suffering from are a narrow subset of that, then we really need to be willing to shift our emphasis and shift our focus on those specific things, which sometimes is difficult to do, especially if something's institutionalized. So our timeline for this is to complete our data analysis on all four areas and have a written strategy report detailing all of that by the meeting on January 13th. I put in the 27th as something for consideration simply because I think there is a benefit to including all of the data we can for 2014 so we can look at a complete 6 years. Also gives Mr. Himes an opportunity when he starts on the 12th to review this and have it, because this will be a very detailed guidebook to all of the experts groups. The second thing is we are compiling all the data and we'll put them in workbooks to give to the expert groups to actually have and consider. And that way they can have understand what the universe is, and then we can go and follow up with additional stuff that they need. And then also having those groups formed by the 31st. Within about 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to expect them to come up with specific solutions for consideration and then implementing them. We want to give enough time to evaluate their effectiveness, but not too much time that we may be going down a path that may not be fruitful. But the idea would be is to take this strategy, apply it for this upcoming year, and then in January 2016, depending on its success and failures, then coming up with maybe a 3-year strategic plan to itemize and look at other problems. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
You know, if I could just add real quick, Mr. President, one of the things that I think is really valuable about RF's plan is that it grows the solutions from within the organization, and if you let the organization help create its own solutions rather than RF and I coming up with a checklist of things that they have to do, you not only get probably a better solution, but you also get organizational buy-in, and that's what we struggle with on all of this, whether it's seatbelt use or driving, it's about organizational acceptance of the strategies, and so that's what this plan brings, I think, that we maybe omitted in the past.
Any questions? It's very solid.
I have a comment.
Yeah.
And that is that, were you saying that if we gave you until January 27th, that we can have all of 2014 included in your report as opposed to less information? So instead of it being January 13th, we push it to January 27th?
Yes, and the reason for that is because for January 13th, for the report to be done, for analysis to be done, we would have to submit the report and complete it by January 8th. Mm-hmm. That only really gives us a few days after the holidays to try to collect all the data, which is not readily accessible, compile it, and insert it. I think if we had a little bit more time, we could incorporate as much as we can into that. So that's the only, that's the main reason.
I don't know how we go about that, but I think that's a...
Me too. So let's assume that that's going to be the case.
Thank you.
Is that okay, Rob?
Oh, yeah. I agree that January 27th.
27.
If you think the report will be more thorough and Chief Himes will have been here, that's helpful. I think that's fine.
And I'm confident within 2 weeks of him being here, he'll have all the answers.
Good. I am too.
Inspector's shaking.
just a couple comments. I feel like... we are moving forward, or you are moving forward, and I appreciate that. This is a topic that we've discussed on many occasions and often have disagreed. So I'm encouraged, and encouraged by the appointment of Chief Himes. I think that's a big step forward to have somebody with his background and experience focused on risk management. And so I think that's quite significant. I also appreciate the presentation today, the sense of the focus of it, that is to help us try to understand the specific areas within which we may be able to make some progress. I'm not sure yet I fully understand all those, but I appreciate the presentation that helps us focus, and I look forward to understanding that better when we see the written report. And just one question. Are you at a point where you think, and I know this is risky, but where you think you might be able to predict when we might actually see results from any of these strategies?
I think, our hope is actually to see some impact by the end of this year. And the reason I can say that is because if we do focus problem solving to specific issues, I think we can yield some results. And if I can give an example of how I've done this in a little bit of a different context in dealing with security, at LAX, when I was there as director of security, there are 1,100 doors that lead into sensitive areas that are alarmed, most of which are unlocked because they have to allow free access in case of an emergency. During any given month, we would get thousands of false alarms and spend an inordinate amount of resources because we had to respond within 5 minutes, according to TSA regulations, with security personnel, police officer, or someone else. Thousands of alarms. And I thought it was a waste of resources. And often, so when I asked for the data analysis, they provided me how many alarms we had per month. Now, there was no way to go after 1,100 doors. So I asked, give me the top 10 doors. And the top 10 doors constituted 40% of the false alarms. And then gave that to our regulatory unit and said, just focus on these top 10 doors. Go figure out if they're broken, if there's an enforcement issue, if there's signage problems, etc. And they did that. They specifically went to the top 10 doors and in many cases fixed it. And within 6 months, we reduced the number of total alarms by 35%. If we get specific solutions to specific issues and problems, I am optimistic that we will have some impact. What that will be, I don't know. Obviously, we're dealing with a lot more people here and a lot more complexity, but I'm more optimistic that we'll have the goal is a short-term reduction, and that this focused approach is more likely to yield that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have one more. I think it's a question. A few slides back when you showed that the numbers of, I guess, potentially liable situations happen.
With injuries?
Yeah.
The injuries? Okay.
Right. What I'm curious about that, yeah.
Yes.
So what I'm curious about is on this pie chart, will you do the analysis that shows what category results in the highest number of settlements?
Yes.
The highest number and highest dollar amount. And I realize the dollar amount is very movable, but yeah.
Yes, and I think it's fair to say that we know that the A and K injuries will lead to the most significant, simply just based on the severity of what's happened, and then especially on the A injuries, medical costs over a lifetime will have an impact. However, I think the most interesting or most useful will actually be within the 71% of complained of injuries, because there are probably factors in there which will lead to some predictability of litigation. What they are, I don't know. And we have been looking at that in a different context. We've had a few what have been designated as preventable traffic collisions that ultimately led to a finding of preventable traffic collision that still led to liability. Mm-hmm. And so with the help of the traffic coordination section, we actually took some of those cases, did a biopsy on them to determine why we think that happened. And we're currently considering some changes to the methods of investigation, et cetera. We would do the same thing or expect the groups to do the same thing here.
Excellent. Thank you.
Steve. No questions.
No questions? Okay. Well, with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very well done.
Thank you. Excellent.
27th.
Thank you.
See the 27th.
We are now on item 8D, Department's verbal presentation, PowerPoint, and discussion relative to the uniform crime reporting and the responsibilities of the newly created data integrity unit.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Morning.
Morning.
President Sobroff, Commissioners, Inspector General, Mr. Chief Hank, Chief of Police, Assistant Chief Mike Moore. I'm joined today by John Newman. He's the officer in charge of the CompSat section of Racer Division. We're here to talk to you today about the establishment of the Data Integrity Unit within CompSat. I'm here to provide you a brief set of backgrounds relative to the establishment of this unit and its purpose. Mr. Newman will provide you a brief PowerPoint. I'm sorry, there's no music with this, so this will be a little quieter than the other one. In understanding the establishment of this unit, we want to also talk about the Uniform Crime Reporting System and what that means and how the department interacts with that system, if you will. That system was established in 1930 by the Department of Justice as a means of establishing a uniform set of crime statistics across the country. In the United States, we have more than 18,000 police agencies from universities and colleges through local municipalities, sheriffs, and so forth. And as they report crime, this system was established to kind of even the field, if you will, so that as property crimes occurred in various parts of the country, we could do a better job of apples to apples, if you will, of comparing crime rates. In participating in this system, it's a voluntary system established by DOJ, FBI. They issue a handbook to agencies such as ourselves to describe this. If you were to look at that handbook, it's a bit daunting. It contains codes and definitions for crime codes. There's 135 of them, of those crime codes, and an additional 27 of the non-crime codes. And those codes are basically given to the departments that as we look at a crime report or as we look at an arrest, we take that book and we try to marry up what is the offense that we're arresting for or the crime that we're investigating and how does it fit into those crime codes. That process, that decision-making, occurs more than 200,000 times a year, 24/7, 365 days across the agency. Historically, as the department has gone about that process, and again, an officer writes an IR, or investigative report, may classify it as a burglary, may classify it as a theft. Watch commander will review that and ensure that the title is accurate to the contents of the report. And then from there, coding and so forth occurs. It's critical. It's a critical decision. It's a critical aspect of what we do because it feeds all of our data systems, and garbage in equals garbage out. Historically, we've made significant efforts to ensure that the accuracy of that data is there. We do that through training of our officers, our supervisors, of our detectives, of our command staff. We also do a series of investigative we do a series of audits or snapshots or inspections. Those occur periodically to look at the accuracy of these determinations, if you will. And we also monitor closely reclassifications or how does the changes occur over the course of the life of that crime or the life of that report. We're at some, for instance, somewhere in the life cycle, a detective would reclassify that report from one crime code to another. We look at that decision as well. In all of our snapshots and inspections, we generally have seen a 95% rate of or better of compliance. That the accuracy exceeds, for instance, in a report of IAID in 2013, out of a stratified sample, they took 105 simple assaults out of a pool of 2,554, and they found that 102 of the 105 were accurately classified. So historically, we have seen that we do have errors, that those errors do vary, but that the errors generally have always been in single digits and have identified areas that we can go back and continue to sharpen the wheel, sharpen the knife, continue to sharpen the accuracy of what we do through training and through guidance. Earlier this year, there was also some media reports, as this commission is well aware, that identified errors that occurred. As we're moving forward today, we want to talk about our latest effort to improve the accuracy of our reports, and that is with the establishment of the Data Integrity Unit within COMSTAT. In this latest evolution, we mean to accomplish and reinforce four aspects. One is to build on the earlier training and provide additional training to those that are responsible for the crime class code determination. Mr. Newman will tell you more about that. Secondly is to develop a state-of-the-art decision trees. Those copies of those were provided to you earlier. They give you a decision process, if you will, that a person at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 o'clock in the morning can, at a watch commander's desk, look at an investigative report or look at a crime report or an arrest report and determine what is the best crime code that should be that should fit this this report. That decision tree is meant to help that. We also continue to conduct inspections, and this unit will do those inspections as well as be the final word, if you will, on what our crime class code classifications are, which can be a mouthful. And what I mean by the final word is that as I look at reports, or as Chief of Detectives, Chief Albanese, or line individuals down to sergeants and officers and detectives look at reports, we will at times come to different opinions as to whether something is a nuanced enough to be a simple assault or an ag assault, to be a burglary or different type of a property crime. And so what the department was doing, what we're doing under the Chief's direction is this data integrity officer in charge will be the single point, will be the person, will be the final determiner. That's important because as we work with California Department of Justice and we work with the FBI and the United States Department of Justice, we need to interpret their interpretations. Recognize that this is a program that, as it applies across the country, with 50 states and 50 different state sets of laws regarding criminal prosecutions, there is a lot of variability. And so all of this is our latest effort to continue our initiative, which is to provide clear, accurate, and dependable statistics, not just for the government, so that across the country we're a participant in this important program, but most importantly for the communities in which we serve, that people can rely upon the information we provide. And with that brief remarks, I will introduce John Newman and have him present the rest of this. And, of course, we're available for questions.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome, John.
Good morning, everybody. In September of this year, Chief Jacobs had come to us with the idea of creating a data integrity unit. And the initial or immediate task that he had asked us to perform with this new unit is to try and provide training in the UCR program to all applicable department personnel by the end of the year. A very lofty goal, given the fact that we didn't have a unit created in the first place. Identified a few folks in our office that were very familiar with the UCR. We asked them to inundate themselves with the UCR manual and guidelines and to become familiar with it. In October of this year, we actually got a D3 that was put on loan to the unit. We're hoping to make that position permanent shortly after the first of the year, and she will be the officer in charge of that data integrity unit. We have a staff currently of four individuals. We're hoping to shore that up a little bit after the first of the year with some additional staffing. The mission of the data integrity unit, as Chief Moore had indicated, certainly training is first and foremost on the mission statement. Thus far, we have completed all of our classes that we had intended to partake in. A total of 14 classes, almost 400 people within the department have been trained in the UCR guidelines. This is just the initial cadre of training. We're planning on having ongoing training that's going to be at a much smaller level, at the area or table level, starting in 2015. We're going to have UCR training as part of the curriculum in the Detective, Watch Commander, and Supervisor School. The intent is to have it all post-certified at some point in 2015. We've worked with Dr. Pinnell and her staff to get the ball rolling on that. The second aspect of the mission, as Chief Moore had indicated, is an inspection of the coding. Different from what IAID does with their full-blown audits, we're planning on more of a strike team approach where we're going to go out and we're going to actually inspect records that we feel may have been miscoded, or we're just going to give them a spot check. We're planning to do that at all 21 areas, and that's going to take place again after the staffing levels get updated after the first of the year. And lastly, again, one point of contact, the D3, Detective Medell, will be the department's UCR coordinator. She's going to be working with her staff. They're going to be the single point of contact and liaison with Cal DOJ and with the FBI to have basically one voice for the department so that we can disseminate information that comes back from the DOJ to the entire department, as opposed to somebody from each division contacting them separately. As Chief Beck had indicated, one of the problems is that translation between penal code and UCR. It's a difficult one when officers are trained in penal code and many of them don't understand what UCR is all about. Certainly there's many of the same characteristics for the crimes that are the same, but there are some differences and subtle nuances. And so the plan is to have the IRs and the arrest reports titled based on penal code, and they're going to be coded based on the crime class code that's most appropriate based on UCR. One of the things that we feel is going to improve upon the process, and we've already put in the request with PRD, is to add a box at the top of the IR and on the arrest report for the watch commander to enter the crime class code into the actual report before it actually gets sent to the records unit. One additional problem that we've been up against is just coding in general. Chief Moore had indicated the ag assaults and assaults in general certainly are a little bit more trying in coding. By FBI's own admission, it's certainly the most difficult crime to code, both simple and aggravated assaults. We feel that all of this training, the changes that we're making to the reports, and the ongoing effort to get the department up to speed and UCR is certainly going to help all of that. The audience for this, primarily the watch commander is going to be tasked with adding the primary crime class code into the report and into that box that's going to be entered on the IR. Watch commander is responsible for verifying and for signing off on the IR before it ever goes to the records unit. And at that point, they're the most familiar with that report. Certainly, if they have any questions, they can go back to the officer for additional information. The second kind of line of defense is going to be the records clerks, where they're going to verify that the initial primary crime class code entered is correct. If they feel that there's any questions or problems with that, they will go back to the watch commander and have a discussion. They're also going to be adding any additional crime class codes up to four that the system allows. Table coordinators are going to continue to verify that coding has been entered in correctly, and they're going to be tasked with most of the reclassifications, as is currently the procedure. Crime analysis detail, OIC, is going to be basically one final review on this and to make sure that the classification of coding is correct and accurate. All of the records in play are basically everything. Chief Moore indicated Part 1 crimes, Part 2 crimes, even the non-crimes are all in play. So all crimes are going to be, all reports are going to be going across that watch commander's desk and are going to be coded appropriately by the watch commander. UCR has a number of specialty rules, the hierarchy rule, separation of time and place, hotel rule. There's also subtle exemptions and exceptions to the rules and nuances that make coding a little bit of a challenge. One of the reasons why we feel it's most important to have one point of contact to go to the FBI and to the Cal DOJ for assistance is that we're planning on having a frequently asked questions section that's going to be posted up on our website where all of the decision trees and all the other material is posted. And we're going to have an ongoing dialogue of kind of those exceptions to the rule one for each crime type. And it's going to be a place where anybody in the department can actually go to see what those exceptions are and certainly have examples. And we're hopefully after just a very short period of time, we feel that the vast majority of examples and scenarios that come into play will be accounted for on that frequently asked questions section. UCR decision trees. I wish I could take credit for the idea. The concept all goes to Commander Malinowski. When he was at Foothill, then Captain Malinowski had the idea of coming up with a document that would be a one-page document and would lead somebody through from start to finish, if they had a report, by answering and asking questions. He had the concept. We modified it slightly, and we created one. He had created one just for the ag assault category, which was one of the ones that we were working with earlier in the year. We created one for each of the Part 1 crimes. We standardized it. All of the available crime class codes for a particular crime are on the upper right-hand side. All of the UCR definitions that are applicable to the particular crime are at the very bottom, starting at the top of the tree. We refer to them as decision trees. You can ask a series of questions and kind of work your way down with notes and extra dialogue in some of the trees. They all have the same format, designed to be as standardized as possible so that they all look the same. The intent of this was to have seven documents, seven pages, that would allow somebody to properly code any of the Part 1 crimes based on these decision trees and only need to know seven pages of information. The UCR guidelines currently, the 2014 version, is 179 pages long. It's a daunting task to get completely up to speed if that's what your starting point is. Getting back to the decision trees, before we actually had finalized the trees, and we were kind of trying to figure out how to prepare them and put them all together for each of the seven crimes, we met with quite a few of the command staff members, assistant chiefs, deputy chiefs, captains. We met with watch commanders, detectives, CAD OICs, records personnel. We met with 21 areas. We met with specialty divisions or specialized divisions. But probably the most important thing, in my opinion, that we did is that we actually sent off these seven trees to the actual point of contacts at Cal DOJ and at FBI. We left them with them for about a week and a half, and then we got on the phone on a conference call with actually our contact from the FBI and from Cal DOJ. We sat in a room in my office with all of the folks that are that make up the current data integrity unit. And with the exception of probably two or three very minor changes that they asked us to make, they were very kind in their words and comments about the trees. They had never seen anything like it before. They thought it was very innovative, and they thought it would be very beneficial moving forward as a tool in the toolbox for properly coding, improving upon the way that we code as a department. As the core value up there says, quality through continuous improvement. This is just one more tool in the toolbox of the coding process that we feel is going to improve upon that process. With that, is there any questions that I can answer?
You know, if I can just thank the CompStat unit. You know, they've had tremendous pressure and they've done a tremendous job. And this is a state-of-the-art training system that'll make the department better. Now, you know, we will still have coding errors. You can't. It's like translating one language into another. You know, there are variables, and there's a lot of it that is subjective. You know, we're literally changing California Penal Code into an imaginary crime classification system created by the FBI almost 100 years ago. So it is a difficult task, but they've approached it not only with enthusiasm, but with the kind of dedication that gets results, and I know that they have.
Thank you, sir.
Questions?
I have
comments.
I have two questions. How many additional personnel do you think it's going to take to put this in place?
We are actually in the process of putting together a request for a D2 and 3D1s. Our concept would be to have a backup supervisor to Detective Medell. We're going to have one detective assigned to each bureau. We thought that was a good way to split apart the staffing. One of the existing four individuals is actually going to stay a crime analyst, and obviously the D3 is going to stay. The other two will probably eventually go back to their other tasks. That will bring the unit at a total of six individuals. We feel that if we were to carry this forward to have staffing around the clock, obviously we're gonna need additional staffing above and beyond that. I think that's probably a later conversation. Yeah. But certainly there is a need for expertise in UCR coding 24/7, not just during day watch, and we're aware of that.
Thank you. And Chief Moore, you said that there was going to be one person who was going to be the ultimate, you know, I guess, arbiter of is it this or is it that, and is
that's the D3 that'll be working the data integrity unit. Obviously, it's a her at this point, and she'll continue to work there, but also closely with Chief Albanese as Chief of Detectives, with Miss Deanna Markley, who's our Chief of Records and Identification. This is a, you know, there's a, again, this is an enterprise. This is the latest addition to further this enterprise, this evolution of you know, screening out and weaning out as much of the error factor as possible. So it's meant to augment and further strengthen and support. It's not meant to be a standalone. Mm-hmm. The collective efforts. CONSTAT will still be, this was matters of reclassification. Why do those reclassifications occur in the first place? Do we have a focus, as Mr. Arif Alakhan indicated, you know, where are errors occurring? Those are things that will become a CONSTAT function for areas and bureaus to answer. Do we have a watch commander that's a point of error? Do we have a particular detective desk? So each of the aspects of the department's operation will come to bear on this.
And did you find that in looking at other departments, you know, I don't know if there are other departments the size of this one in California, but similar, is that the process they use, that they funnel essentially all the coding up through one person, or...
Yeah. Well, first of all,
I should ask the ones that are more accurate than not, because that's what we're striving.
This is a everyone strives for a single point of contact. We think this is the most sophisticated means of accomplishing it. We're confident that our error factor within our reporting structure is one of, if not the best in the business. This has been closely scrutinized with the evolution of our crime reduction for the past decade, and we continue to refine it, and will continue to refine to make every improvement possible.
And when does this become effective?
Now.
Yeah, basically now.
Okay, good. Thank you.
The decision trees are out there. The training's been accomplished. Again, it's a ship-in process, so we're already, you know, again, they're already in application for the classifications that are occurring now.
Did you learn from the media discussions that you had? You had numerous discussions with numerous people, and numerous agreements and numerous disagreements. Has that process factored into this final work product?
I'll answer that.
Yeah.
I want to thank the LA Times and Joel and Ben are both here. You know, they spent a huge amount of time working with CONSTAT, working with Chief Jacobs, retired Chief Jacobs. Let me see if I can keep from crying when I say that. And we're the impetus for a lot of this. You know, we have done our own audits for many years, but you know, the media puts a hot light on these things. And so, even though we recognize, or we believe that we were good at this, especially as compared to the rest of the industry or the rest of the profession, we weren't good enough. And this will make us better.
Good.
Thank you all.
And we do have one public comment card. We have Mr. Ted Hayes. And he is not here. Okay. We will now move. He's here? Okay. Mr. Hayes?
He's coming around. With the turmoil that's going on around our nation, a lot of concern is being placed upon the race
and ethnicity of officers and suspects or victims. I'm given to understand that reporting does not require that designation be provided to the Justice Department or to the FBI. Chief Parks had a problem because during the consent decree, a lot of information had to be collected in that area. He didn't like doing that. It had to be pointed out to him it was not a consent decree between the police department and the feds, but the city of Los Angeles and the feds. Now, there is an elephant in the room, an inconvenient truth, and that's about the fact of black crime. And some quarters are saying it should not be reported. 1% of this population commits 27% of the murders. Guess who that might be? Serena Williams and Venus Williams, street crime, relative killed. Chief Berta Park's granddaughter, street crime, killed. Bill Cosby's son, street crime, killed. So that kind of gives you the highlights of people who are killed in street crimes and the rapes. Now, I'm glad the Hawaiian Gardens have been cleared up as well as the Ramona Gardens, thanks to the Joint Task Force. Very glad that's taken care of. But one thing we have to be concerned about is whether or not we're going to collect the data on the race, ethnicity, even religion, of people who are committing crimes. That's very important. Now, the officers know what's going on. There's no question in my mind. They know where the crime in this community is taking place and who's doing it. But I think the data should be required collection of the police department.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're now on item 8H, department's report dated December 10th, 2014, relative to the jail operations audit number 14-002.
My observation on this was that the things that need improvement, thank God, don't have to do with the treatment of the folks in the jails as far as this audit goes. It looked like there were paperwork issues or administrative issues, but those issues don't trickle down or affect what actually happened in the system. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Most of our findings were administrative in nature.
Mm-hmm.
However, let me go ahead and present.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chief Beck, Commissioners, Mr. Bustamante, Mr. Chief Fink, Mr. De La Guerra. I'm Lieutenant Cheryl Barada, and with me are Detective 3, David Kennedy, Sergeant 2, Daniel Hahn, who is the project manager. We're from Internal Audits and Inspection Division and here today to present the jail operations audit. Also here today representing jail division is Captain David Lindsay and Commander John Sherman, Assistant to the Director, Office of Special Operations. Internal Audits and Inspection Division conducted the jail operations audit in accordance with fiscal year 2013-2014 Department Audit Inspection Plan. The purpose of the audit was to evaluate the department jails for conformance with department policies and procedures. The audit evaluated jail operations in the department's three main jails. That would be Metropolitan Detention Center, 77th Regional Jail, and Valley Regional Jail. The audit included the evaluation of life safety equipment, that's self-contained breathing apparatus, automated external defibrillators, suicide intervention kits, inmate housing classification, administrative segregation record keeping, inmate classification questionnaires, division booking records, inmate health and welfare record keeping, jail inspection records, general housing checks, special confinement records, and sobering cell inmate welfare forms. Inmate property release process record keeping, jail custody record. Non-categorical use of force investigations, articulation of legal basis, supervisors administrative investigation, and watch commander's insight and management oversight, as well as non-categorical I'm sorry, as well as complaint investigations. That's the availability and completeness of audio recordings, interviews, and evidence. The high-risk standard of the maintenance and availability of life safety equipment was met. However, the audit identified discrepancies in administrative procedures related to documentation of supervisory oversight, inmate checks, and release of inmate property. The audit also revealed a need for additional training in the area of investigations. The findings were presented to the commanding officer, Jail Division, who expressed general agreement with the findings. Jail Division subsequently submitted a response addressing each of the findings and provided a detailed list of action taken to rectify the identified discrepancies.
Good morning, morning, Commissioners. I'm Commander John Sherman from the Office of Special Operations, and I'm going to let Captain Lindsay get into any details or any questions that you may have relative to the specifics of the audit. But I just wanted to assure you that both Captain Lindsay and I have taken a very, very close look at this and given it a significant amount of attention and command emphasis at our level. Of note, the three section OICs from the three regional jails are present here today for this presentation to the Police Commission. This audit and these administrative oversights are a recurring theme with both Captain Lindsay and myself. I have personally conducted a number of audits at all three facilities, a number of inspections at all three facilities since this audit occurred, and I am continuing to see gradual improvement in the efforts of the employees. In many instances, we saw human errors relative to the documentation of some of our inspections. And then in other areas, we saw some system flaws where we can tighten up some of the processes and systems we have. In either case, we're fixing those areas and we'll improve in those areas. And I'll let Captain Lindsay get into any specifics you may have relative to the audit.
Just a few other things. We've identified the officers that had the omissions or deficiencies. We've provided training to them during my monthly deployment meetings. We talk about the results of the audit, not only this audit, but we continue to do monthly audit or monthly inspections on our own to gauge our progress in doing better in these areas. I discuss it with my OICs to try to get this to trickle down. Additionally, I do my own unannounced inspections of the jails, including Pacific and Hollywood, which weren't covered in this audit, to identify any areas that might need to be addressed. And then I'll be happy to answer any specific questions you may have.
Any questions, Rob?
I just have a few. One of the issues that we hear about here often from the public has to do with signage in the detention center and in the jails. And I didn't know if it seemed to me that was not something as part of this audit. Is that something that you look at otherwise, or was that here and I just didn't see it?
It was not covered in this particular audit. I'm aware of some of the signage issues that have been brought up in past police commissions. I believe they have all been addressed a while ago, and we even had the city attorney review the signs to make sure they were compliant with all state laws.
Great. And is that issue something that will show up in an audit that we'll see at some point? Or?
Absolutely, we can include that.
Great. Include it in an audit.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Second, page 7 in the audit, at the top, says inmates may be segregated for the following reasons, and there's a list of reasons, one of which is sexual orientation. And I just was curious, I understand the statement is permissive, inmates may be. I know that in the last several years there have been significant efforts made, particularly to MDC, with respect to gender identity. And so I didn't know whether going forward that's something that you would specifically include, refer to, be auditing, paying attention to, or not.
we can absolutely also include that.
I think that would be a good idea, in particular because the department's doing such a good job on those issues. Also, on page 7, the last paragraph, I'm trying to understand what the last sentence means. It says all 10 inmates were segregated properly. Does that mean that, well, can you help me understand what that means, given what the prior part of that paragraph says?
Basically, this comes to a point of documentation.
Okay. So what should have happened with the exception of the documentation?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. And then the last is beginning on page 10, but proceeding through the rest of the report, I didn't see department responses, and I didn't know whether that's I just not seeing them, or the department's responded and that's subsumed somewhere. Can you just help me understand that? I understand the general statement that you are in agreement, but I just, for 3B, 3C, 4, 5B, 5C, 6A, there were recommendations. I just didn't see a response. I don't know if I'm missing it or...
The department or jail division did respond to it. I don't, in regards to how much of it was included in the report submitted to you, it may have been condensed down.
Okay.
And the document I possess, sir, has all of those headings, so it may be that you just didn't get a copy of that page.
Okay. Well, then, in that case, if you just provide me with a copy of that, I'd appreciate it. And
what page do you have?
Yeah.
What page is there?
It starts on page 1 and then page 2 and 3, and I've got a signature block here for the signature block is on page 4 with all the appropriate signatures, yep. And you referenced 3B, 3C, they're on page 2.
I'm confused.
Your last documents.
Last document?
Yeah. Go to the back of the document. That is it right there, sir.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you. Apologize for not seeing it. Thank you.
I have one question. So mine is on page 19, and it's under the heading of the supervisor's administrative investigation, so that when a use of force was found, and this is the case the MDC second case, where a witnessing officer was interviewed by the supervisor who directed the use of force, and the suspect statement is not consistent, et cetera. Can you explain to me what that means?
Basically, the suspect stated a series of events. However, we have at the MDC over 179 cameras, and so when the video from the cameras, they're always included within investigations. His statement was inconsistent with what was on the videotape, and the officer's statement was consistent with what was on the videotape.
Got it. Thank you.
Good job. Thank you.
Thank you. Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now on item 8I, Department's report dated December 10th, 2014, relative to Department employee involved traffic collision reporting, investigation, and adjudication, revised, and fleet safety report form 01.13.00 revised.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Commission President, members of the Commission.
You attract a crowd.
I do.
We all left.
This is not one of those items they're probably hanging on.
Who's hanging? Someone's
anyone?
Hanging?
No one's hanging on this.
Okay,
one.
Good.
I'm here today to present to you the recommended special order on revising the manner in which we report, investigate, and adjudicate employee-involved traffic collisions. There's a lengthy order that's on here. It's detailed. It's lengthy by requirement because, as you might expect with the reporting, adjudication, and of such an event, we have a number of different aspects of it. I wanted to provide the Commission a brief background as to why these revisions are before you.
because this does date back some time. In 2008, the commission at that time worked with the department in establishing a point system, if you will, for the adjudication of the vast majority of officer-involved traffic collisions, with the basis being that most of those collisions as accidents were matters of performance quality rather than in instances requiring disciplinary action. And that still holds true today. In establishing the point system, it replaced a system that each traffic collision that was preventable initiated a complaint, a 128. And so it was thought that, and still believe that in governing our employees' conduct, that as to traffic collisions, we should investigate them aggressively and review the circumstances of what led up to the collision itself and the adjudication. But that in the most instances, those failures can be expected to occur given the environment in which our personnel operate their vehicles over the course of an officer's 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, as with our chief. That
you don't drive anymore.
Who's not on leave? Yeah. But in this system, for example, the lowest level, you end up getting a single point, much as you do in your private insurance and much as you do with your driver's license in the state of California. And based upon a period of time, your driving record is considered in balance, if you will. So you can have a failure without there being discipline. You can have a shortcoming without there being a catastrophic consequence. In looking at this system that was established again in 2008, in 2010, the IAID conducted an audit or inspection of how is those revisions working, how were the investigation and adjudication process performing, and then identified in a report of December 2010 that we were falling short in the timeliness of our stated goals. How long, there was 5 days, for instance, provided for the time the collision investigation was done for it to get to the command to begin the review. And in fact, extremely ambitious, and in fact, we weren't making that. Additionally, it found that over the course of time that our ability to track exactly where those collisions were in the investigation or adjudication or closure was not clear. So where in the process is, for instance, the collision that occurred 3 months ago? And so the report was brought to this commission. In the process of that, the Inspector General was also asked, you know, how is the system performing? And there was concerns that there were, by this point system, we had somehow created a circumstance where people believed that there wasn't a consequence for collisions that involved unsafe driving. So the department took a look at that very closely. We've been working on it since that time. It's an involved process because as we came up with recommendations and modifications, those also required a consultation with our league, our bargaining unit for our officers, and then that extended through some further discussions. And where we're at today is a system that we believe makes adjustments, improvements upon the existing system. It still maintains the point system for its value, but it also establishes through some mechanisms I'll talk about in a moment some needed traction or accountability. Just briefly, I wanted to talk with you that you were provided with fleet safeties as far as collisions that have occurred since 2009. Are preventable collisions. Basically, the department, as we look at an employee-involved collision, we make a judgment. Was it preventable or was it non-preventable? So in discussing a non-preventable collision, an officer who's otherwise following the rules of the road and operating without all due regard, and a person pulls out from a private driveway and hits them in the side of their vehicle, we would look at that in absence of anything that compounded the officer's action. For instance, if it was driving at night without lights on, in the absence of that, that would be an otherwise preventable collision. The officer wasn't responsible for the basis of the collision. We look at that because obviously an officer's conduct is important to us in the collision, while also recognizing that they operate in a motoring public in a traffic in an environment that at times can be hostile. Since 2009 to 2013, our preventable traffic collisions have dropped 19%. So
as we have worked on reducing our traffic collisions, particularly our preventable traffic collisions, we have seen success. As to the to attributing that to this point system versus our other initiatives that have been ongoing, traffic collisions are one of the primary influences on an officer's on his mortality or their survivability in this profession. So it's an important area that we look at. I won't assign it to this, but we're confident that the point system hasn't, at this point, we don't believe the point system has contributed to an air of officers believing that there's not a consequence for their driving. However, there was an area there that we wanted to bring focus to that was really brought up back in 2010, and that is in what's called previously the level 2. There was a level 1, 2, and 3, the third one being the most severe, and with which the third level involved gross negligence or reckless disregard for safety, a criminal act, if you will, a death or a serious injury of a motorist, that being the level 3. The level 1 was a slow speed, less than 10-mile collision fender bender that didn't involve injuries. The level 2 is where much of our work was at, which may involve complaint of injuries or actual injuries themselves and other driving by the officer. That's 15 to 20% of our book of work of collisions. But it's an important, as Mr. Arif Alakhan had said earlier, it's an important to look at groups of our collisions to understand how do we further tease out differences and how can a policy and our protocols further improve our performance in areas of our work. What we came to is, and what's in this order, is that in that level 2, we believe that the earlier standards were insufficient. That a level 2 that was in there that had a person that was not driving recklessly, but perhaps were driving unsafely, perhaps unsafe speed for the conditions, or unauthorized code 3, that previously that would have been a level 2, that we need to break that out and make an additional level. So I'll draw your attention that's one of the most striking differences here is that we established a fourth level, if you will. And it was stuck between levels 2 and level 3. And it basically involved that you have a person, an officer involved in a preventable traffic collision, that there was a complaint of level of injury, perhaps, or no injury, but the officer was driving unsafe for the conditions. The officer was driving or failed to yield for another motorist. In that instance, it wouldn't just be 2 points and we'll see you later. But instead now, we'll provide for further accountability. Mm-hmm. That accountability may be a notice to correct deficiencies, identifying clearly to the officer that not accidents and collisions do occur, but as it's preventable, the officer's conduct was engaged in this or enabled or facilitated this collision. And in more serious instances, a complaint investigation, which would allow for suspension or ultimately even more serious events. We wouldn't expect that absent the officer's conduct being repeatedly substandard. Which, by the way, that repeated or egregious acts become a level 4. The point systems really don't change other than this added layer of accountability. And again, I'll go back to the reason it was created was to work on that period of level 2 that we wanted to tease out and break apart some of those that had some conduct that we thought deserved better sanction than simply a point.
Are you implementing it now?
It will upon your approval. The other changes I want to quickly point out to you, we've also reestablished an Executive Fleet Safety Committee made up of the Department's Traffic Coordinator, that being Deputy Chief Mike Downing, Special Assistant Constitutional Policing, and others. Those are involved in those repeat offenders. Those individuals that have a series of accidents over 3 years or a significant accident involving a death of a motorist or serious injury, this committee is to then make recommendations the Chief of Police as to what actions other than points may be necessary. The last two matters that are important, we established or reestablished, if you will, the role of the Bureau Chiefs. Previously, the area captains, as a reminder, looked at a collision. They would determine whether it was preventable or non-preventable, and then it went to the Department Traffic Coordinator. And if that captain made the decision that it was non-preventable, that was final. And there were, over the course of time, we've seen errors in that assessment.
And so the role of the Bureau has been reintroduced, and the issue there is to ensure consistency, to ensure adherence to standards, and to take a second look, because there may be, again, a difference of opinion. This is a business at times of nuances that people may differ, intelligent people. And the Bureau's role is to come in and ensure consistency and accountability across the agency for standards. Lastly, we believe, and this is important, and it's consistent with something we've seen with our use of force, or categorical, non-categorical, and that is in instances of a traffic collision, preventable or otherwise, an officer will receive a debrief for any time there's complained of injuries or more. So the aspect there is to, you're involved in a collision, perhaps it's your fault, and someone has injured yourself or your partner or others. If we want to debrief with that officer that collision and understand, keep it in perspective, but at the same time also identify and give them a moment of reflection of what other actions should they take to perhaps avoid those in the future when possible, recognizing that accidents are just that. They're accidents. But what are some of the underlying actions we may be involved in that is contributing that as individuals? So that's an effort after a long morning and early afternoon for you to condense this down, and certainly I'm available for any questions.
Go ahead.
I just have one comment, one question. The comment is to thank you both for the report and the progress and for the briefing you gave to Commissioner Soboroff and me last week. It seems to me this is it's taking a lot of work. It's in good shape, and I look forward to the board approving it and your implementing it. The question was, I noticed just fortuitously last week, some news articles about the Sheriff's Department considering implementing a policy restricting officers' use of computers while they're driving, and I know that's a different sort of piece of this. It's a substantive rule or not as to what we require or prohibit. And I'm just curious if you have thoughts about that and whether that's something the department's thinking about or has already implemented or.
I'm not, as I sit here today, I believe it's a challenge. One of the challenges we have is officers multitasking,
right.
and that, while we make efforts with the radio and with the MDCs to keep your head up, it is a constant effort. We do benefit as a department with a two-officer deployment in most of our units, whereas the Sheriff's Department, right. Many of those are lone officers. We remind our sergeants, who are generally activated by themselves, to be mindful of distracted driving. It affects us, whether the uniform is not an armor against that. So it is something that we talk about. It is also something that we look at when we have collisions as to the officer's actions, whether it be on a cell phone or with a mobile digital computer.
Thank you.
Motion for approval.
Move approval of the item.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Good. Good job.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay. We're now on item number 9, public comment. We have Mr. Ted Hayes.
So close. There's one thing that we always complimented the Mexican Mafia on. It was a decree or paper bull, whatever you call it, that if any Latino was engaged in a street crime where a child or an innocent person was killed, they better not go to prison because they would not survive. We always, in the black community, thought that some gangster or criminal element should make an edict like that based upon the number of homicides, drive-bys, were taking place where innocent people were being killed or harmed. So I would imagine that somewhat the Mexican Mafia has been subdued thanks to their joint effort with the FBI, LAPD, and immigration, and that's worthwhile. I mentioned two communities where I mentioned Hawaiian Gardens and Ramona Gardens, because when Hawaiian Gardens had its incident, Supervisor Yvonne Burke said she would not respond to that fact because she did not want to blame the incident. She didn't want to incite anything. And I thought the same thing when the Ramona Gardens took place, and I questioned
some members of the department on that. And thankfully, and I'm so thankful, Chief, that it seems that there's been some resolution in that area. And we can rest now. Thank you.
Thank you. We are now on item number 10. There are no closed session items. We are at the point of adjournment. Is there a motion for adjourn?
Move adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Meeting adjourned. Thank you. Good meeting, everybody.
Good run. You have the meeting with the city.